out the truth.
Inspired by real events, the life and death of Georgi Markov.
It is, not to put too fine a point on it, a warning from history.
Breaking the Rules, The Markov File, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, tomorrow afternoon at 3.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday the 15th of November. Good morning, this is Today with Katja Adler in London and Justin Webb in New York. The top headline this morning, the anti-vaccine campaigner and conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been nominated by Donald Trump to be the United States' new health secretary. Mr. Trump says Americans have been crushed by the industrial food complex and drug companies. Critics are calling the appointment one of the worst in American history. I've been speaking to the former Republican strategist Mike Murphy about the latest pick for Trump's top team.
Well, most of the serious people around health policy behind closed doors in both parties think he's barking mad.
We'll also be hearing what Trump's more conventional cabinet picks mean for foreign policy and for defence in Europe.
The other main headline, a group of climate experts has told the United Nations that its COP summits are no longer fit for purpose. We'll speak to one of the scientists behind that letter. And also in the programme, Gladiator 2 hits cinemas today.
It is an art,
choosing gladiators. They're usually prisoners of war.
We'll hear about the discovery on Hadrian's Wall that sheds light on gladiators in Roman Britain. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Donald Trump has nominated the prominent vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health in his incoming White House administration. Mr. Kennedy, a member of America's most famous political family, had been an independent candidate for the presidency before withdrawing and backing the Trump campaign. He has a record of promoting conspiracy theories. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
This is another highly controversial cabinet nomination by Donald Trump, who appears to be enjoying shocking the political establishment and daring Congress to defy him when it comes to approving his candidates. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a divisive choice to be in charge of public health because he's a vocal vaccine skeptic who's promoted debunked theories that link inoculations with childhood autism, and he's also said he wants to get rid of fluoride in drinking water because he believes it lowers children's IQs. Mr. Kennedy will also try to take on the food industry, which is not used to being under attack from Republicans. He wants much stricter regulations on ultra-processed food and has even spoken out against Donald Trump's beloved McDonald's. There is continuing controversy over President-elect Trump's choices for other posts, including Attorney General and Defense Secretary. All these nominations will need to be approved by the Senate, so this could turn into a battle of wills between Congress and President Trump, and it could test just how powerful the incoming president really is.
The tech billionaire Elon Musk, who's been appointed an advisor to Donald Trump, is reported to have met Iran's ambassador to the United Nations. The New York Times says the pair spoke for more than an hour, focusing on how to diffuse tension between Iran and the US. Neither Mr. Trump's team nor Iranian officials at the UN have confirmed whether a meeting took place. A group of scientists and former political leaders has said the United Nations climate talks are not fit for purpose and need a comprehensive overhaul. The country hosting COP29, Azerbaijan, has been criticised after its president said oil and gas were a gift of God, and an official appeared to try to arrange a meeting to discuss fossil fuel deals. Our environment correspondent Matt McGraw reports from Baku.
Agreeing action on climate change at international level requires the consensus of almost 200 countries. Many experts are worried the COP process is not capable of the actions needed to tackle the fast-moving climate crisis. Now, in a letter to the UN, a number of senior figures in the climate movement are urging major reform. They've been prompted by concerns about the current host, Azerbaijan. Its president, Ilham Aliyev, welcomed world leaders here with a passionate defence of the use of natural gas. Today's letter says countries shouldn't host climate conferences if they don't support the phase-out of fossil energy.
The Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, has said Britain must rebuild relations with the European Union. Delivering his Mansion House speech in the City of London last night, Mr. Bailey made some of his strongest comments yet on the impact of leaving the EU.
Now, I've said many times as a public official, I take no position on Brexit per se, and that's very important. But I do have to point out consequences. The changing trading relationship with the EU has weighed on the level of potential supply. The impact on trade seems to be more in goods than services, which I don't think is particularly surprising, but it underlines why we must be alert to and welcome opportunities to rebuild relations while respecting that very important decision of the British people.
BBC News has found that it's still possible to buy zombie knives and machetes weeks after the government banned them in England and Wales. The weapons were advertised on the websites of knife retailers in the UK. Some of the orders were shipped from abroad. Our correspondent Dan Johnson reports.
New restrictions came into force in September, banning the manufacture, sale and possession of zombie-style knives. These are defined as a blade more than 8 inches long with a sharp-pointed end, a sharp edge and one additional feature, a serrated edge, holes in the blade, spikes or multiple sharp points. We found knives matching that description on the websites of British knife retailers. One initially confirmed our order, then said they could no longer sell the weapons. Three others fulfilled our orders and sent us illegal knives. Two of them appear to have been shipped from overseas. Border forces responsible for intercepting prohibited weapons entering the country, but not every package gets checked. Commander Stephen Clayman from the National Police Chiefs Council said the ban was having a positive impact, but he conceded there was more to do. The Home Office is already reviewing the online availability of knives, and earlier this week a consultation was launched on the banning of ninja swords.
The government spending watchdog says the Home Office paid £15 million for a derelict prison contaminated with asbestos as it rushed to find accommodation for migrants it wanted to move out of hotels. A report by the National Audit Office says Rishi Sunak's government paid more than was needed to acquire the Northire site in East Sussex. Will Vernon has the details.
The report says the Home Office cut corners and made a series of poor decisions to hastily approve the purchase of Northeye. It claims the previous government's promise to end the use of hotels to house asylum seekers created political pressure to acquire new sites quickly. This led to ministers handing over more than £15 million for Northeye, more than double what the previous owners paid just 1 year earlier. And officials who approved the purchase were not told about the additional £20 million needed to clean up the asbestos-ridden facility. The Home Office said the report related to the actions of the previous government, and it remains committed to achieving better value for the taxpayer.
The French Academy has finished the new edition of its definitive French dictionary, but after taking nearly 40 years to compile, the volume has been described by critics as already out of date. It includes the word yuppie, but not TikToker.
Thanks, Jane. Now for the weather forecast, over to Simon King at the BBC Weather Centre. I wonder if you made it into the new French dictionary, Simon.
I doubt it very much. Yeah. Good morning. I'll tell you what will be in the dictionary. Wintry weather, because that's what we're going to get into next week. Although there are some uncertainties on the details, I have to say, as we go into next week. Yes, it is going to turn much colder and there is going to be some snow, which could be significant snow. But at the moment, we just don't know exactly where that will be. It could be across northern England, North Wales, but maybe up into Scotland as well. So keep an eye on the forecast in the coming days. But for today, it's pretty cloudy for many of us. We've got some mist and fog patches, just like we've seen over the last few days, really. Some clear spells where temperatures have dropped down close to freezing, and that's more likely across Wales and the Midlands and Southwest England this morning, where there is a touch of frost out there. The mist and fog will tend to lift and clear away, but there'll be some sunshine across southwest England and the Midlands through today and into the afternoon in particular, maximum temperatures of 9 to 13 degrees. For eastern and southeast England, pretty cloudy to start the day, but by late morning into lunchtime, there'll be some sunny spells developing and staying largely dry with some sunshine through the afternoon with highs of 9 to 13. Now for Wales, northwest and northeast England, it's a cloudy start for most, but some clear skies in northeast England and a touch of frost here. A few mist and fog patches around. There'll be some sunshine northeast England through this morning and then through Wales into the afternoon. Highs of 9 to 12 degrees. And for Scotland, for North Ireland, pretty cloudy. Some rain arriving in northwestern areas later, but some sunshine across eastern Scotland and temperatures of 12 to 14.
Simon, thank you very much. It is 6:09. Let's have our first look at the papers. And Donald Trump's nomination of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as his new health secretary is the main news for many U.S. papers, including USA Today, which says his appointment has been celebrated by some, despite his lack of a medical or public health degree, after his pledge to make America healthy again during his failed run for the presidency, which resonated with a large portion of voters who are worried about what's in their food. The Boston Herald is not so keen, indicative of the general reaction, it is fair to say, noting Mr. Kennedy is one of the most prominent anti-vaccine activists in the world, with views decried as dangerous by many public health officials. And in a damning editorial, the New York Post, the tabloid here in New York, which is often quite admiring of Donald Trump, is not in this respect. It claims the appointment breaks the overriding rule of medicine, do no harm, warning that Mr. Kennedy's views on health are a head-scratching spaghetti of what can only be described as warped conspiracy theories.
Back in the UK, the issue of so-called non-crime hate incidents features on several front pages. The Times says it's found evidence of confusion amongst police after Freedom of Information requests revealed that children as young as 9 have been investigated for classroom incidents where no law was broken. The Daily Telegraph reports that 3 police forces have been involved in the investigation into a social media post by one of its journalists, Alison Pearson, prompting what the paper calls a major backlash from critics who fear a threat to free speech.
And the Daily Mail says that Keir Starmer has been told to police the streets, not tweets, after Downing Street said the Prime Minister supported police action to capture data on incidents and comments which are not serious enough to constitute a crime.
The Guardian says more than 250 unpaid carers could face trial after falling foul of what the paper calls draconian benefit rules over the past 6 months. It reports that campaigners are calling for a halt to prosecution of those who've been overpaid by the Department for Work and Pensions, while an independent review of the carers' allowance benefit takes place.
And with the headline Stop the Cosmetic Cowboys, the Daily Mirror has launched a campaign to ban unlicensed surgeons from carrying out procedures such as Brazilian butt lifts in the UK. It says a woman has died and hundreds of other patients have been left injured after high-risk operations at unregulated clinics. The paper's calling for further legal safeguards, including a requirement for practitioners to have malpractice insurance. Now, the COP process at 6:11 is in some trouble, it seems, and a letter to the UN is calling for very big changes to the environmental talks. Justin Rowland, our climate editor, is on the line. Who's the letter from, Justin?
Guys. The letter's from some really serious people. We've got Ban Ki-moon, former Secretary General of the UN, former UN chief. Cristiana Figueres, you may remember her. She was the woman that ran the UN climate process during the landmark Paris Agreement back in 2015. Mary Robinson, former Irish president. There are climate scientists, other luminaries on it. And they're upset, by the way, that Azerbaijan has been conducting itself during this conference. There was that rather extraordinary statement by President Aliyev, the president of Azerbaijan, who described oil and gas as a gift of God, which is a very odd way to start a conference designed to get the world to tackle climate change. And then there was a story that we did, that I did, in which revealed secret footage of the chief executive of COP29, the Azerbaijani team running the conference, appearing to discuss oil and gas deals during his role. And what the letter says is this conduct suggests that the process isn't working. They talk about changing the selection process for countries so that maybe countries who are only countries that are committed to the transition away from fossil fuels could become hosts. They're saying these COP conferences should be smaller, more frequent, more focused on action, with countries held accountable, which all sounds really sensible when you see the list like that, except, of course, that this is designed to be an international process drawing all the countries of the world, kind of whatever their opinions, and the idea is to kind of draw them in, to rally them to action, even if they're sceptical, you know. So, it's inconsistent with that idea, with the way that effectively that the UN works, Justin.
And if it is inconsistent with that idea, Justin, do you think that will persuade the UN to bat it away?
Well, the letter writers amended the letter this morning to say that they do believe in multilateralism. I think the UN won't bat it away. Simon Steele, the guy who's running the UN climate process at the moment, in his opening address, he acknowledged that the COP process isn't working, in the sense he said, look, it is delivering outcomes, but it just simply isn't fast enough. It's not delivering change fast enough. He said, look, we would be heading for 5 degrees Celsius temperature rise. Now it's 3. That 2 degree, I mean, still a very worrying temperature increase, but that 2 degrees, he says, is a measure of the success of this process. So I think the UN's position, they haven't formally commented yet, would be, look, it's working, we acknowledge it's not perfect, but it's the best we've got, and we've got to continue with it and try and make it work better.
Justin Rowler in Azerbaijan. Thank you.
It is 14 minutes past six. The UK must rebuild relations with the EU whilst respecting the decision of the British people who voted to leave in 2016. The words of the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, last night in a speech to bankers about a number of reasons he believed the UK economy wasn't reaching its full potential. Mark Dashan is our business correspondent. Hi, Mark.
Ah, morning.
Good morning. The topic of Brexit is still very delicate, isn't it? And Andrew Bailey was very careful to say this wasn't his personal opinion, it was his professional opinion, but it has been difficult to quantify the effects of Brexit. There's been so many concurrent crises.
Well, absolutely, yeah. The Governor is certainly a man who chooses his words carefully, shall we say. He doesn't want to be seen to be interfering in political affairs. So when he speaks, and speaks on something as sensitive as Brexit, well, the world does tend to sit up and listen. He chose last night's Mansion House dinner. That's a key event. We all get very excited about that in the financial world. Rachel Reeves was also there addressing city bigwigs. But Andrew Bailey did pretty much overshadow her, saying he doesn't want to take a public position on Brexit, reiterating that, but he feels duty bound to point out the consequences. He said Brexit has weighed down the potential of the economy in various ways, mainly the impacts of trade barriers on goods, things like food and farm exports, really. But as you say, it's tricky to assess really the true impact, given we've had multiple economic shocks. I'm talking COVID, the Russia-Ukraine war, of course, the impact on oil prices, even from tensions in the Middle East. The consensus, the best guess really from the OBR, the Office of Budget Responsibility and other analysts, is a hit of 4% of the size of the economy over a 15-year period. So the Governor said that only underlines why we must be, in his words, alert to and welcome opportunities to rebuild relations with the EU, while of course respecting that decision of the British people to leave.
And now you mentioned there, Mark, the agricultural sector that's taken a hit since Brexit. What can we expect? What did he suggest of how the UK could change things with the EU to get closer whilst respecting the result of the Brexit referendum?
Well, there's various things the government could do. And this is interesting, of course. It comes at a moment when Donald Trump has re-entered the stage, hasn't he, threatening those tariffs potentially on US imports. And that has been suggested to us behind the scenes. There may be a scenario where the UK has to choose to get closer economically to the US or closer to the EU. So the government saying officially they are resetting the relationship with their European partners. They want to work together for peace, security, prosperity and to improve trade. But Labour has been pretty clear they will not look to reverse Brexit. But of course, there's a whole sort of spectrum of things really they could do on things like youth movement, food and farming, financial services to ease those frictions while keeping to that promise. Now, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, didn't go there last night. She didn't address Brexit in her speech. But it's fair to say the bankers listening would have lapped it up. They're feeling battered, bruised by the budget, which they feel left quite a lot of financial pain on them. They may well see this now as a sort of starting gun, really, firing that towards building better relations. I think we can call this a pretty clear nudge from Andrew Bailey. That in a world where the government is desperate to get growth firing, the budget didn't exactly shoot the lights out, did it? There was a pretty obvious option to explore lying just across the English Channel.
Mark, thank you so much. And we'll be getting back to what might happen across the English Channel a bit later in the programme.
Time now, 18 minutes past six, and sticking with the economy, is it the job of a financial regulator to promote growth? The Chancellor says yes. What do the regulators themselves say? Felicity Hannah has more on that. The rest of the day's business news. Morning, Fliss.
Morning, yes. This also comes out of the Mansion House event last night. Rachel Reeves said in her speech that she's written letters to regulators in the city, like the Financial Conduct Authority, urging them to focus more on growth. Now, this was something that was started by the last Conservative government, which gave the FCA a legally binding second brief of prioritising growth and competitiveness. Let's talk to Nikhil Rathi, who's chief executive of the FCA, joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you make then of this letter from the Chancellor? Because some people listening will think, hang on, isn't a regulator's only job to protect customers and ensure companies act fairly?
I was at the dinner last night, and the central point the Chancellor was making was that the central mission of the government, of us all, is to support the growth of the economy, to deliver prosperity for our citizens. And to deliver that, every part of the system needs to be pulling in that direction. And that includes, of course, us as the regulators who play an important part in setting the investment climate, playing our full part. So you'll have seen over the last year, we have made some radical changes, for example, to the listing rules to enable technology companies to scale up and grow, to allow fast growing companies to acquire others around the world, to enable that risk to be taken so that savers in the UK can get the returns they need.
So do you think that you've already taken steps and that the Chancellor's letter perhaps hasn't acknowledged the steps you've taken to make it more possible to take risk?
The Chancellor was very clear in acknowledging all the work that has been done over the last year, but she was also setting out the course that we're working on together with the government on many other steps for the future, most notably pension reforms. We have one of the largest pension systems in the world, but only a very limited amount of our pension money goes into infrastructure or growth companies in the UK. And that's a very different picture to other markets like Australia or Canada. And what that means is that over the long term, UK savers are not getting the returns they need and therefore not getting the living standards that they could get in retirement. And we'll be supporting the work there to consolidate those pension funds and to support greater risk-taking.
But speaking of living standards, people who remember the financial crash might think regulators going for growth means more risk.
There's an important balance to be struck here, and that's why having this secondary objective has been important, because it enables us to have a proper debate about how do we strike the right balance between the risk that's needed to support entrepreneurs, support companies that are growing, support businesses that want to invest, whilst also making sure investors and consumers are protected. One area we'll be consulting on next month, for example, is providing financial advice and guidance. This is absolutely critical for everybody to be able to decide on their financial future. And at the moment, the market isn't working as well as it could. People are not getting the advice they need when they need it at a price they can afford. And so we'll be testing some ideas about how to make that far easier for many more millions of people.
Doesn't this give you conflicting responsibilities? For example, the FCA is looking into car finance at the moment. Some of the biggest banks have seen their share prices take a hit because there are concerns they'll have to set aside hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of pounds in compensation. Isn't it the case that we're going to keep seeing situations where the FCA protecting customers means that businesses and therefore growth take a hit?
We do think that we're able to support competitiveness and growth. We have a very successful financial centre, but that doesn't have to come at the expense of high standards around integrity and consumer protection. At the moment, we have a record number of cases that we're tackling financial crime. We've taken more charges in the last couple of years than we have done previously, taking a very robust position there. You mentioned the issues on motor finance and the historic work that has been underway there, and we are very actively engaged with the industry to make sure those issues are sorted out. So absolutely, we have a role, a central role to play to make sure that we protect the integrity of the market. That can happen alongside supporting the investment climate, the risk climate that's needed for growth of the economy.
Can it happen alongside? Because you've also come into criticism from politicians for policies like name and shame, and plans to begin publicly naming companies facing an enforcement investigation at an earlier stage. How do you reconcile that kind, that kind of duty with a growth remit?
I think that all market participants have an interest in a clean market with high integrity. And on the proposals around enforcement transparency, we are looking at how we can adjust them to make sure that we can be transparent to protect consumers, to ensure clean markets, but in a way that properly addresses the impact on firms. And I'm sure in the coming weeks we'll be able to find an appropriate balance there, which will command a good degree of consensus. So I think you can achieve this. You achieve this through discussion, open discussion. The Chancellor set the tone yesterday in terms of understanding that with risk there also comes challenge, there may also come failure, and that there needs to be a degree of political acceptance of that. And as long as that's there, I think we can navigate through this and deliver the growth and support that the country needs.
Now, I also want to ask you a bit about what we've just been hearing. The Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, who also spoke at the same event, talking about Brexit. Briefly, if you can, do you think Brexit has weighed on the city and financial services?
The governor made his comments yesterday, and the Chancellor also talked about the importance of the trading relationships we have, both with the US and the European Union. We're a large open economy. I travel around the world all the time, people come to the UK for financial services business because of the talent we have here and our ability to trade cross-border. And we have a role to play to make sure that those cooperative relationships exist with other regulators to enable that trade to happen. And we work closely with our European partners. And obviously, the government has now set a direction where they would like to deepen some of those relationships on trade. And we support that.
Nikhil Rathi, Chief Executive of the Financial Conduct Authority. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, listening to that is Simon French, Chief Economist and Head of Research at Panmure Liberum. Simon, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
What's the view of investors in the city on this? Has the FCA, have other regulators hindered growth?
Well, trying to link the speech of Andrew Bailey and what you just heard from Nikhil, Andrew Bailey was talking about Brexit in the context of a very sluggish UK growth performance since the global financial crisis. And the judgment is, and I think it is the correct judgment, that while absolutely necessary to deal with the excesses that led to the global financial crisis, actually regulation in many ways has gone too far and has stifled the deployment of capital into growth companies, and actually therefore stifled economic growth, wage growth around the UK economy. So what you heard from the Chancellor and supported, I felt, by the Governor's speech was trying to get the balance more in favour of economic growth and responding to the data. And it is the data that growth has been poor since 2008.
Well, an organisation that hasn't seen poor growth has been Meta, Facebook's parent company, but it's been hit with an €800 million fine for tying its marketplace platform to Facebook. The EU Commission said that shut out competitors and exposed Facebook users to marketplace, whether they liked it or not. Meta says the Commission has failed to prove any competitors or consumers suffered and that it plans to appeal. Simon, it's hard to see how Meta wouldn't use one of its platforms to promote another. Are antitrust regulators like the EU fighting a bit of a losing battle?
Well, they've been fighting this battle for a long time. This judgment has echoes of a 2003 judgment they made against Microsoft, which fined Microsoft €500 million at the time for integrating its media player into its Windows platform. So 21 years on, they're making this judgment against Meta, saying that there are unfair trading practices associated with having the marketplace tied to the social network. I would say it's not so much they're fighting a losing battle. I just think they're on the wrong side of the argument here. The very justification and the efficiency associated, we've been talking about growth, haven't we? The efficiency and growth associated with tapping into the network to provide a marketplace is absolutely what you should be leveraging the world's biggest social network to do.
Simon French, thank you very much indeed. Now, it's just over a week since the Bank of England cut the base rate from 4.75% to 4.75% from 5%. That was the second reduction in 2024. And yet, despite that, some of the UK's biggest lenders like NatWest, Nationwide, HSBC and Barclays have upped their mortgage rates for customers. New data from the financial information company MoneyFacts shows that the average two-year fixed mortgage rate is now 5.44%. A five-year deal is 5.17%. I'm joined by the CEO of Home Financing at Skipton Building Society, Charlotte Harrison. Charlotte, morning.
Good morning.
I suppose, first of all, then, are you increasing rates?
So before I just talk about what Skipton are doing, I just think it's helpful to have a bit of context around the correlation between bank base rate and what we're seeing in the market with lenders who are increasing rates. And I think what people tend to expect is that a reduction in bank base rate is a linear reduction in mortgage rates. Now, that might be true for some of our variable rates and base rate trackers, where customers will see rates reducing in line with that reduction. But the vast majority of mortgage rates in the UK are on fixed rates. And that takes in a different factor, which is longer term borrowing costs. And what we've seen over the recent weeks is the expectation of that longer term borrowing cost has slightly adjusted. And that's what the market's reacting to.
So there's lots of different factors then that feed into borrowing costs and push up rates.
Exactly. So market will look at future predicted interest rate movements, and that will take account of data like inflation, wage growth, unemployment. There's even, you know, conflict in the Middle East and demand pressures and supply pressures.
Does this mean that you'll also be increasing rates?
So we assess our rates on a weekly basis. We will have a movement next week. We'll have some small rate increases, but we're also having some small rate reductions as well. So we monitor the market.
Do you think mortgage lenders are more pessimistic now?
Not at all. And actually, our data shows that we're in a really strong mortgage market, and we're predicting a strong mortgage market for next year. If I look at some of our group data from our estate agency, we can see that in the last couple of weeks, despite rate increases, we've had really strong levels of activity. So viewing activities up 18% on the same time period last year, and sales activities up 19% for the same time period last year. So I think customers and borrowers are more attuned to some of the rate movements that we've seen, and that we're not in an ultra low interest rate environment, and we have seen a bit more volatility, but buyer sentiment still remains very strong.
Charlotte Harrison from Skipton Building Society, thank you very much.
Fliss, thank you. 29 minutes past six to the sport. Here's Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. After all the talk of players withdrawing from the England squad, they had an emphatic 3-0 win over Greece in Athens. Interim manager Lee Carsley chose to leave the England captain, Harry Kane, on the bench. And after the victory, Carsley explained his decision for selecting Aston Villa's Ollie Watkins ahead of Kane.
We want more leaders within the squad, but, you know, with that we have to give them a chance to be leaders. And I thought, you know, it wasn't any slight on Harry, far from it. He's so important to England and our team, and he'll start on Sunday, and he obviously he'll be captain. So, but Ollie took his chance, and it was brilliant to see.
England will return to the top tier of the UEFA Nations League with victory over the Republic of Ireland at Wembley on Sunday. The Republic of Ireland themselves had a 1-0 win over Finland and are third in the group. Scotland face Croatia tonight. Scotland face Croatia tonight before playing Poland on Monday, and head coach Steve Clarke feels they can move up from their current position at the bottom of their group.
The performance we've had so far, we probably deserve a little bit more points-wise than we've got. But we've got two games to come and still a chance to be really competitive in this group and stay at that level, which is what we all want.
There's commentary of Scotland versus Croatia on 5 Live from 7:45. Northern Ireland host Belarus at Windsor Park later. Rory McIlroy is joint top of the leaderboard with Tyrrell Hatton at golf's season-ending DP World Tour Championship. Both golfers are on 5 under par after day one in Dubai. The BBC's golf correspondent Ian Carter reports.
McIlroy has all but cemented the Race to Dubai title, grabbing a share of the lead with Tyrrell Hatton with an excellent 67. The Northern Irishman is now 6 shots clear of the only man who can deny him, South Africa's Tristan Lawrence. More newsworthy, though, was McIlroy's response to reports that, subject to ratification, American golfers are going to be paid to play in future Ryder Cups. McIlroy says the payments risk ruining the purity of the match, that Europe have no interest in being paid, and actually saying that he would pay to play in the Ryder Cup.
England's men's cricketers have an unassailable 3-0 series lead over West Indies after winning the third T20 by 3 wickets. And in tennis, Great Britain's Henry Patton and Harry Heliavara, who are the Wimbledon doubles champions, made it 3 wins out of 3 on their way to the semi-finals at tennis's season-ending ATP Finals. World number one Jannik Sinner and the US Open finalist Taylor Fritz have also qualified for the final four in the singles. Later in the programme, we'll hear from the British number one Katie Bolter ahead of Great Britain's Billie Jean King Cup tie against Germany today. And the racing tips return for the big meeting at Cheltenham. So 2:55 at Cheltenham, number 7, Fame After the Glory, and 3:30 also at Cheltenham, number 2, Potter's Charm.
Thanks, charming Carthy. Let's look ahead to next week.
Best Medicine on BBC Radio 4.
Comedy, hosted by Kiri Pritchard-McLean.
Best Medicine is the show where comedians, doctors, scientists and historians join me to dissect funny and fascinating medicine.
Historically, all surgeons were butchers and barbers back in the day.
So after a lobotomy, would they show you the back of the head with a mirror? Celebrating the past, present and future of medicine.
So I think the best medicine is origami surgical capsules.
They're a great band. I saw them at Glastonbury, actually.
That's the new series of Best Medicine with me, Kiri Pritchard-McLean. Starting next Tuesday night at 6:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time now is 27 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Katya Adler in London, Justin Webb in New York, and Jane Steele with the news.
Donald Trump has nominated the well-known vaccine sceptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health. Mr. Kennedy had been an independent candidate for the presidency before withdrawing and backing the Trump campaign. Mr. Trump said Mr. Kennedy would defend Americans from the industrial food complex and drug companies and help make America healthy again. The tech billionaire Elon Musk is reported to have met Iran's ambassador to the United Nations. The New York Times quoted Iranian sources as saying the pair focused on ways to diffuse tension between Tehran and Washington. Neither Mr. Trump's team nor Iranian officials at the UN have confirmed whether a meeting took place. A group of scientists and former political leaders says the United Nations climate talks process must be reformed. In a letter written as the latest COP summit takes place in Azerbaijan, the group says the summits are not fit for purpose and need a comprehensive overhaul. The signatories also argue that host nations should be fully committed to the phasing out of fossil fuels. The Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, has said Britain must rebuild relations with the European Union. Delivering his annual Mansion House speech in the City of London last night, Mr. Bailey said Brexit had weighed on the UK economy. Weeks after the government outlawed zombie knives and machetes in England and Wales, BBC News has found that it's still possible to buy them. Three British retailers advertising the weapons on their websites accepted orders for illegal knives, which were then delivered. The National Police Chiefs Council said the ban was having a positive impact, but there was more to do. Israel's Attorney General has accused the country's far-right security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, of politicising the police force for his own ends. The Attorney General has said the Prime Minister should reconsider Mr. Ben-Gvir's position. Mr. Ben-Gvir described what had happened as an attempted coup. The government spending watchdog says the Home Office paid £15 million for a derelict prison contaminated with asbestos as it rushed to acquire sites to move migrants out of hotels. A report by the National Audit Office says Rishi Sunak's government cut corners and made a series of poor decisions.
Thank you, Jane. 25 to 7 is the time. Donald Trump has been celebrating his first full week as president-elect with a black tie dinner and speechifying at his home in Mar-a-Lago. Our correspondent there, Jess Parker, has been telling me he appeared to be enjoying himself.
The confidence definitely, I think, was one of the, you know, very obvious elements of that speech. And I think what we've actually seen over the last week, I mean, there he was in his black tie outfit, dispensing thanks to different people in the crowd, including some of his kind of cabinet picks. Also, Elon Musk, I mean, he made a quip that the tech billionaire's presence at Mar-a-Lago has been somewhat lingering, joking, like, I can't get him out of here. And he teased a big announcement for tomorrow about his interior secretary before just deciding to announce it anyway to the audience. I mean, I think he was enjoying himself. He was enjoying the crowd, enjoying the moment as well. And I was speaking to someone this week here in West Palm Beach who goes to some of these sort of Mar-a-Lago dinners and was describing how the audience stands up and applauds Donald Trump when he enters the room for these things. Then there's some glad handing. Then Donald Trump sometimes gets out his laptop to start DJing. It really feels at the moment that he is the king in his castle and he has a lot of courtiers.
And yet behind the scenes, there is some real disquiet. Is it fair to say about some of the picks for his cabinet?
Yeah, there is disquiet, including within his own party. So you've got the Attorney General pick, Matt Gaetz, and then the Health Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., two roles that would have to get or go through the Senate confirmation process. And it's interesting because, you know, you look at RFK Jr., Donald Trump could have given him a more advisory role. That was kind of being mooted around, a sort of health czar role. He didn't have to give him the health role, overseeing multiple health agencies, but he chose to, and he's chosen these other more contentious cabinet choices that, as I say, will have to go before the Senate, we expect. And it seems to me that Donald Trump is totally willing to really test the new Republican Senate majority. So you mentioned confidence at the beginning. I think these appointments do exude confidence and a willingness to fight and test and push the boundaries of his power. So in a way, it's vintage Donald Trump.
Jess Barker in Florida. Thank you.
It's 22 minutes to seven. Many of the papers this morning splash on Rachel Reeves' maiden Mansion House speech. It's an annual glitzy dinner for bankers in the City of London. The Financial Times highlights the Chancellor's call for city regulators to focus on economic growth. The Eye focuses on a loosening of rules around bankers' bonuses. And The Guardian looks to the Chancellor's call for banking regulations to be loosened. Damian Grammaticus is the BBC's political correspondent. Morning, Damian.
Morning, Katya.
Is it fair to say the Chancellor essentially told the City of London regulators, dial up the risk?
Yes, she did, very much so. And I think two things you need to consider here are the audience and the context. So the audience, of course, city financiers. So it's a speech tailored to them and the message the government wants them to hear and they want to hear. Also the context, though, the backdrop, you have the budget that big tax raising budget, squeezing businesses on national insurance. That's caused a lot of discussion. And so this is kind of the flip side, if you like. This is the Chancellor of the government wanting to say, look, we have a plan for growth and this is part of it and you are part of it. So, yes, what she was talking there was about asking city regulators to as much focus on growth as on regulation. And well, that, I think, comes down to, sorry, just one quick thing, is trying to free up the banks from some of the sort of staff processes they have to go to register and regulate staff and slim that down to reduce costs.
And of course, that, you know, the regulating for risk came from the financial crisis. But back to the audience and the Chancellor trying to reassure the city, did she persuade her audience that this was a back to growth focus after the fright for many in business of the budget?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that will depend on. One is the broader context of the government's reforms more generally, because growth will depend not just on what she tells regulators, but on the success of what the government is able to do across a range of things. So it's industrial initiatives, it's push to get investment in green industries, in infrastructure, all that sort of thing. But of course, remember as well, the other thing that's happened in the last sort of week or so, Donald Trump's election and the complications that may bring with the picture for tariffs, trade, relations with the US and the EU, and Donald Trump's predilection for tariffs, his stated desire to put some on, which could cause, you know, difficulties and turbulence in global trade. That could weigh on growth. So the government has a complicated picture with which to try to navigate and deliver what it wants.
Of course, that blanket threat from Donald Trump of 10 to 20% tariffs being slapped on all imports. Damian Grammaticus, thank you.
19 minutes to 7 is the time. There are new restrictions on the sale and the possession of so-called zombie knives, but it seems with limited impact. Let's talk to Dan Johnson, our correspondent. What have you been able to do, Dan?
Yeah, the law changed on zombie knives at the end of September, drawing a further definition of the sort of weapons that should be banned, the sort of weapons that have been used in many stabbings, particularly those involving teenagers. Well, since the 24th of September, we've kept our eye on a number of websites of knife retailers, UK websites, and some appeared to still be advertising the sorts of weapons the government intended to ban. So we tried this out. Now, one retailer did tell us that he couldn't sell the weapon that was advertised, but three others did fulfill our orders, and four banned weapons were delivered to our door through the post. So we're talking about things like machetes. We got two 18-inch serrated edge machetes. We got a hunting combat knife that's got a 10-inch blade and a serrated edge. These are very nasty looking things. We got something that's described as a fantasy master skull crusher. It's a sword with a red edge and spikes and additional points on it, holes in that blade as well. The sort of thing that many teenagers either carry around for a status symbol, something for respect, and the sort of thing that has been used in crimes. These are exactly what the government was trying to ban when it changed the law at the end of September, but it seems that it is still possible to get them through certain websites. The complication with two of these was that despite no indication when we placed the order, they were actually shipped from abroad. So there are questions here for the police and law enforcement about how this ban is working, and for Border Force about whether they are effectively intercepting banned items coming into the country.
But there is no question, is there, that the people who supplied you these weapons are breaking the law?
to all intents and purposes, they are British retailers. They either have .co.uk websites. In some instances, they are registered companies in the United Kingdom with a registered address. It does seem that some of them are shipping from abroad, but the police say if they have a British front window, if they have a connection in this country, then they are breaking the law when they bring that item into the country, especially if that is unknown to the buyer. So there are issues there about how these things are available, how they're getting through the net. There are issues about what is being advertised and for sale on the internet, because there was much more that we didn't buy. And then there are big questions for the police about what is going on social media, because they're already reviewing the online sales of weapons there, because this is what was plainly available to see openly on the internet. They know, they say that they believe the bigger threat is actually what is going around on social media, what sort of weapons are being handed amongst gangs, amongst teenagers. And that's why the government is reviewing that. The Home Office is expecting that review to conclude at the end of the year, with a question about how the government can more effectively move there. But there are questions about whether banning these things, trying to draw ever tighter definitions of what should be banned, is effective and can be enforced. And it seems it is still possible to get these deadly weapons delivered to your door.
Dan Johnson, thank you.
It's coming up to 7:15. MPs have warned that the increase in national insurance contributions announced in the budget could force care homes to close and lead to job losses in hospices. A health minister told them that the government understood the pressure charities faced, but gave little encouragement to those hoping for a U-turn. David Cornock reports.
Rachel Reeves spent yesterday preparing for her big Mansion House speech, but her ears may have been burning as opposition MPs in the Commons ripped into her budget and its possible impact on family doctors, hospices and charities.
If they are forced to close, lives will be lost.
GPs will have no choice but to cut services and staff numbers, and patients will pay the price.
What we're going to see is care homes closing down, yeah, pharmacies closing down, hospices not being able to provide the service.
The focus of their ire? The Chancellor's decision to increase national insurance contributions for employers from next April. The NHS is exempt, but other organisations which provide healthcare are not. The Conservative MP Luke Evans, who's a former GP, said that undermined the Chancellor's claim to have invested more in the health service.
Many in the health sector would have been pleased to hear the announcement of the extra funding going to the NHS, only for the joy to be struck down by the realisation of a broken manifesto promise not to raise national insurance contributions.
The Health Minister, Karen Smith, hit back.
He talks about joy. There was no joy when we inherited the mess that they left back in July. He talked about people being tipped to the brink. They absolutely were.
But Dr. Evans had added up the bills and given a bleak prognosis.
The hospice sector expects the cost to be £30 million, closure and redundancies. For GPs, the initial assessment could be £260 million, closure, redundancies and the cost of 2.2 million appointments.
Karen Smith said the Chancellor had already taken into account the impact of the changes when she announced the extra money for health and social care. But she was pleased Luke Evans had forced her to come to the Commons to answer his urgent question.
It gives me the opportunity to say to GPs, dentists, hospices and every part of the health and care system that will be affected by changes to employers' national insurance contributions that this government understands the pressures they face and takes their representation seriously.
But she gave little sign of a rethink. MPs queued up to highlight the impact of the tax rise. This was the Liberal Democrat, Muneera Wilson.
Shooting Star Children's Hospice in Hampton serves children with life-limiting conditions and supports their families, not just across my constituency, but right across South West London and Surrey. They're facing a bill of £200,000 with a national insurance hike, on top of all the inflationary costs they've had to absorb.
She thought hospices should be exempt from that hike. The minister praised their work, but wouldn't go that far.
We absolutely understand the pressures and the precarious situation that many of them have been left in after the last 14 years of the last government. We are absolutely willing and keen to talk to all sectors, hospices and others.
That didn't appear to win over her critics. A Conservative, Jerome Mayhew, summed things up bluntly.
Increased taxes on hospices, care homes, GPs and pharmacies. Is this a deliberate decision by the Labour government or just a cock-up?
Karen Smith repeated that she understood the precarious situation hospices were in, one that predated the change of government. Another Conservative, Sir Roger Gale, demanded more urgency.
Charities like Shooting Star Children's Hospice and the Demelza House Children's Hospice, who are facing problems now. They can't wait for discussion through the normal channels while this cock-up is put right. When is something going to be done about it, please?
By now, Karen Smith was beginning to lose patience.
The Honourable Member says that it's an ill-thought-through budget. I don't know whether he agrees or disagrees with the extra funding that this government has secured to give to the NHS after the disaster of the last 14 years.
Most Labour MPs echoed the Minister's analysis. Anna Dixon pointed out that lots of GP surgeries had closed under the Conservatives.
It's a bit rich for the party opposite to be now pretending they care so much about general practice, given that 1,600 practices closed on their watch.
The Conservative, Sir Edward Lee, is the father of the House, the longest-serving MP. He pointed out that the current debate about assisted dying had focused attention on the lack of hospice spaces, while the NHS was affected by a lack of care homes.
So, leaving aside the name-calling between parties, may I beg the Minister to reconsider and to exempt hospices and care homes from this national insurance inquiry?
Karen Smith said she understood the point, but gave him the same answer she gave everyone else. Ministers would continue their conversations with the companies and organisations whose bills are due to rise.
And that was David Connor reporting on Yesterday in Parliament. It brings us to 10 to 7. Anyone who listens regularly to this programme will know a good deal about Andrew Malkinson, who spent 17 years inside for a crime he didn't commit. He is saying now that he has been left to rot by the Ministry of Justice, who are still not coming up with a compensation package. He's given an interview to The Guardian in which he says, "Almost every day I'm having to jump through some hoops for the authorities. I'm really struggling here and it feels unjust." Let's talk to Emily Bolton, the lawyer who represented Andrew Malkinson during his criminal appeal. Ms. Bolton, good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
I mean, I suppose the first and obvious question, we talked to him back in the summer and you got the impression then, quite understandably, that he was struggling a bit. Is he still?
He's absolutely still struggling. He's frustrated. And these demands that he's receiving from the Department of Work and Pensions in order to continue to be given benefits are really causing him a sense of outrage. And what you've got to understand here is it's about being mistrusted. Like, what more does Andy have to prove? They want proof he's innocent, even though a court set him free and the authorities have apologised in order to even accept him onto the compensation scheme. They want proof. Then after that, they're going to want proof that he was harmed by 17 years in prison for a rape he didn't commit. And I think we can agree he was. And now he feels like the Department of Work and Pensions want more proof from him week after week that he can't work, that he is who he says he is, that he needs the benefits. And you can understand, while he has been so forbearing, and I think listeners to this programme have heard what a dignified and forbearing man he is, he feels like the state is trying to break him.
I don't understand why it is that they can't give him a sort of interim payment. I mean, he's obviously going to get money eventually, one assumes. Do you know why it is that they can't just give him a sum of money that will mean that he doesn't have to go through these hoops to go to the Department of Work and Pensions?
It's because the system for compensation was changed such that it was no longer automatic that you got compensation when you came out of prison having had your conviction quashed. That system is simply not fit for purpose because it is so slow. And there were so many aspects of it that Andy has had to challenge recently since his exoneration. First of all, the board and lodging requirement, which was exposed on your programme, that prisoners were required to pay board and lodging out of their awards for the time they spent in prison. He's also challenging the cap, which is £1 million, which hasn't been raised since it was first introduced. He's been told that's premature to challenge. He's recently won a battle to get the law changed so that any interim payment he receives in the future won't be counted against his eligibility for legal aid so that he can sue the Greater Manchester Police for what they did to him. So those fights have taken time. But also now he's in a situation, it's really simple. The Secretary of State just has to approve him onto the scheme. And once that approval has been obtained, he can then apply for that interim payment. Presumably that will also take time. Right. But
on that though, what the Minister of Justice has told us, we've been clear those who suffer devastating miscarriage of justice like Andrew Malkinson should not have to use their compensation to bring legal action against those responsible. And we're working to make a decision on Mr. Malkinson's application for compensation as quickly as possible. That's the phrase you used.
Referred him to published statistics and said that that was a 31-week wait. And he shouldn't be referred to statistics. This is really straightforward case. He needs an interim payment yesterday, Justin. I mean, I cannot begin to describe how frustrating and outrageous this is from where he's sitting. 31 weeks is 7 months. That takes him into next spring. That's their average processing time. So why does it take so long for a government that's already accepted that he's been wrongfully convicted to accept him onto a scheme that provides compensation for people who have been wrongfully convicted?
Emily Bolton, lawyer for Andrew Malkinson, thank you very much.
It's 6 minutes to seven. The NHS is launching a search today for nearly 150,000 volunteers to take part in a series of research trials that we're told could transform cancer treatment. Three cancer projects have been selected as part of the NHS DigiTrials initiative. Well, Dr. Vin Diwakar is a National Director of Transformation at NHS England. Good morning.
Good morning.
Would you tell us what are the three projects that have been selected for the trials and what are they trying to achieve?
Yes, so the three trials are firstly the largest ever study of skin cancer. Secondly, there's a study looking at genetic risk factors for cancers such as ovarian cancer, colon cancer, breast cancer. And then there's another study looking at early detection of swallowing tube esophageal cancer. And then there's a final study that's not to do with cancer. It's the care of newborn babies needing complex surgery. Now, the NHS DigiTrials service is one which uses routinely collected information to identify whether you're eligible for one of those studies. And then we'll send you either a text message or a letter asking you if you'd like to take part. So I'm a consultant, and when I was working full time, you would be recruited to these studies if you came to my clinic. I had to remember that the studies were live and then refer you to a research nurse, or sometimes the research nurse would have to sit in clinic. This DigiTrial service is much fairer because we're able to identify every patient who might be eligible for the service, get in touch with you via text or via letter. And that's much fairer because we can contact everybody and it's much faster, which means, of course, we get the results of the studies much quicker, which contributes to the treatment and detection of those diseases long term. So my main message is, if you do receive a text or you do receive a letter from us asking you to participate in a research study, please consider it and please volunteer to take part.
So what we've said here is NHS says this could transform cancer treatment. What is the broader impact of these trials? Because we talked about 150,000 volunteers being looked for right now, but DigiTrials initiative aims to sign up tens of thousands of volunteers over the next couple of years.
Yes, it does. Well, of course, these are four studies that we're particularly looking for volunteers for those common types of cancer. But we've previously used the DigiTrials service, for example, for something called the NHS Galeri trial, which was for a blood test to detect cancer very early. And that achieved the fastest ever recruitment to a clinical trial in the UK, with over 140,000 volunteers in just 10 months. And the service also supported the recovery trial, which many of your listeners may remember, looked at the positive effect of giving steroids to patients who were seriously ill with COVID. And so this is a really good service. It can identify patients very quickly who will be eligible for studies. And again, it means it's much fairer. So the key message is, if you get a text or a letter, that's the way that we are contacting people looking for these. We know that this service works and help to recruit thousands of people. And of course, you get the results, and you can see from those two studies that I've mentioned how quickly we're then able to find results that can only help patients. So to give you one example, the Best for Heartburn Health study, we are looking for 120,000 volunteers for that study. And previous smaller scale studies showed that the particular thing that they're testing in that study detected 10 times more cases of a condition called Barrett's esophagus, which is an early sign of esophageal cancer compared with waiting until your symptoms appeared. And that's the sort of transformative effect it could have on the NHS, because, of course, if you have cancer detected early, you can be treated and then you're more likely to survive.
Absolutely. Dr. Vin Diwakar, National Director of Transformation at NHS. NHS England. Good luck with those trials and thank you.
It's not funny, it's true.
Lily Allen and Makita Oliver.
Keats, I've got some questions for you.
On BBC Sounds.
Tell me what you've enjoyed about our podcast so far.
I like that you've got more and more comfortable in this space and I've watched you show all parts of yourself.
We've both cried.
Miss Me with Lily Allen and Makita Oliver.
We're just us having a chat.
Feels like we've been doing it forever.
We kind of have.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now for the weather with Simon King.
Katja, thank you so much indeed. Good morning. There's a lot of cloud out there this morning. Once again, some patches of drizzle, some mist and fog as well. But we've got some clear skies in southwest England, the Midlands and northeast England, and that's allowed temperatures to drop close to freezing. Now, as we go through today, across Wales, the Midlands, eastern and through southern areas of England, any cloud, mist and fog should tend to clear away and there'll be plenty of sunshine into this afternoon. Maximum temperatures getting to about 9 to 13 degrees. Across northern England and Northern Ireland, some clear spells, as said, in northeast England. So a bit of sunshine initially, but the cloud increasing here, and it's going to stay fairly cloudy for all parts really into the afternoon. And again, temperatures about 9 to 13 Celsius. Across Scotland, we've got some clear skies across the east of Scotland. Again, quite chilly, but that's where we have some sunshine today. Elsewhere across Scotland, lots of cloud, a little bit of drizzle, with more significant rain pushing into the far northwest of Scotland later on, and highs of 12 to 14.
Simon, thank you very much. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. Katja Adler in London, Justin Webb in New York. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 15th of November. The headlines this morning, Donald Trump has chosen the vaccine skeptic and conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as his health secretary. We'll be discussing the reaction here in the US after the news. And one other headline, climate experts have told the UN, the United Nations, that the COP summits are no longer fit for purpose.
Coming up in the next hour of this programme, what will Donald Trump's picks for his top team mean for NATO, Europe and Ukraine?
We're the only nation in the world that is able to go toe-to-toe with China. But we just have to be honest. The United States cannot both lead the conventional defense of Europe and also lead the conventional defense of Asia.
And how gladiators were celebrities here in Britain long before they made it big in Hollywood. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Donald Trump has nominated the prominent vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health in his incoming White House administration. Mr. Kennedy, a member of America's most famous political family, had been an independent candidate for the presidency before withdrawing and backing the Trump campaign. He has a record of promoting conspiracy theories. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
This is another highly controversial cabinet nomination by Donald Trump, who appears to be enjoying shocking the political establishment and daring Congress to defy him when it comes to approving his candidates. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a divisive choice to be in charge of public health because he's a vocal vaccine skeptic who's promoted debunked theories that link inoculations with childhood autism, and he's also said he wants to get rid of fluoride in drinking water because he believes it lowers children's IQs. Mr. Kennedy will also try to take on the food industry, which is not used to being under attack from Republicans. He wants much stricter regulations on ultra-processed food and has even spoken out against Donald Trump's beloved McDonald's. There is continuing controversy over President-elect Trump's choices for other posts, including Attorney General and Defense Secretary. All these nominations will need to be approved by the Senate, so this could turn into a battle of wills between Congress and President Trump, and it could test just how powerful the incoming president really is.
The tech billionaire Elon Musk, who's been appointed an advisor to Donald Trump, is reported to have met Iran's ambassador to the United Nations. The New York Times says the pair spoke for more than an hour, focusing on how to diffuse tension between Iran and the US. Neither Mr. Trump's team nor Iranian officials at the UN have confirmed whether a meeting took place. A group of scientists and former political leaders has said the United Nations climate talks are not fit for purpose and need a comprehensive overhaul. The country hosting COP29, Azerbaijan, has been criticised after its president said oil and gas were a gift of God, and an official appeared to try to arrange a meeting to discuss fossil fuel deals. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath reports from Baku.
Agreeing action on climate change at international level is a major challenge, as it requires the consensus of almost 200 countries. Many experts are worried that the slow-moving COP process is not capable of the actions needed to tackle the fast-moving climate crisis. Now, in a letter to the UN, a number of senior figures in the climate movement are urging major reform of the COP, prompted by concerns about the current host, Azerbaijan. President Ilham Aliyev welcomed world leaders here with a passionate defence of the use of natural gas and his country's plans to expand production. In today's letter, the senior figures say countries should not host climate conferences if they don't support the phase-out of fossil energy. They also want smaller, more frequent COPs with greater accountability for the promises that countries make.
The Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, has said Britain must rebuild relations with the European Union. Delivering his Mansion House speech in the City of London last night, Mr. Bailey made some of his strongest comments yet on the impact of leaving the EU.
Now, I've said many times as a public official, I take no position on Brexit per se, and that's very important. But I do have to point out consequences. The changing trading relationship with the EU has weighed on the level of potential supply. The impact on trade seems to be more in goods than services, which I don't think is particularly surprising. But it underlines why we must be alert to and welcome opportunities to rebuild relations while respecting that very important decision of the British people.
Resetting Britain's relationship with Europe may not be straightforward if the Trump administration imposes tariffs on EU imports, while the UK seeks a trade agreement with the US to avoid them. Speaking at the same event, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, was trying to keep her options open.
I look forward to working closely with President-elect Trump and his team to strengthen our relationship in the years ahead. And of course, our biggest trading partner is the European Union. We will not be reversing Brexit or re-entering the single market or customs union, but we must reset our relationship.
BBC News has found that it's still possible to buy zombie knives and machetes weeks after the government banned them in England and Wales. The weapons were advertised on the websites of knife retailers in the UK. Some of the orders were shipped from abroad. Our correspondent Dan Johnson reports.
New restrictions came into force in September, banning the manufacture, sale and possession of zombie-style knives. These are defined as a blade more than 8 inches long with a sharp-pointed end, a sharp edge and one additional feature, a serrated edge, holes in the blade, spikes or multiple sharp points. We found knives matching that description on the websites of British knife retailers. One initially confirmed our order, then said they could no longer sell the weapons. Three others fulfilled our orders and sent us illegal knives. Two of them appear to have been shipped from overseas. Border Force is responsible for intercepting prohibited weapons entering the country, but not every package gets checked. Commander Stephen Clayman from the National Police Chiefs Council said the ban was having a positive impact, but he conceded there was more to do. The Home Office is already reviewing the online availability of knives, and earlier this week a consultation was launched on the banning of ninja swords.
In the last few moments, figures have been released showing that the UK economy grew by 0.1% in the 3 months to September compared with the previous 3 months. That was slightly below analysts' expectations. The Office for National Statistics says there was subdued growth across most sectors. Israel's Attorney General has called on the Prime Minister to reconsider the position of the country's far-right security minister, alleging that he has politicised the police force. Itamar Ben-Gvir heads a small but powerful religious nationalist party in the government of Benjamin Netanyahu and has run the country's security ministry since 2022. Our correspondent Joe Inwood reports from Jerusalem.
Itamar Ben-Gvir is as controversial as he is powerful. He helped form the coalition that put and keeps Benjamin Netanyahu in office. As security minister, he's been accused of politicising the police, hiring and firing for ideological reasons. This letter from the Attorney General sets out that case. It says Mr. Ben-Gvir allegedly influences and intervenes in a blatant, improper and repeated manner, and that Benjamin Netanyahu should consider whether he is fit for office. In response, Itamar Ben-Gvir has accused the Attorney General of an attempted coup. It once again sets the judiciary on course for confrontation with the government.
Australia's e-safety commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, has said the country's proposal to ban under-16s from social media will require manufacturers of electronic devices as well as social media platforms to protect children from online harm. The Australian government will introduce legislation in Parliament next week, which would make it the first country in the world to implement such an age limit for sites including Instagram and TikTok. Ms. Inman Grant told Five Live she was optimistic the online world could be made safer.
I will be asking each sector of the technology industry, from the device manufacturers to the app stores, to the ISPs and the search engines, to make sure that they're putting safeguards in place to protect children from harmful content like pornography, self-harm, and disordered eating material, so that there are safety protections built in up and down the stack, so there isn't a single point of failure, if you will.
The government spending watchdog says the Home Office paid £15 million for a derelict prison contaminated with asbestos as it rushed to find accommodation for migrants it wanted to move out of hotels. The National Audit Office says Rishi Sunak's government paid more than was needed to acquire the North Eye site in East Sussex, which was ultimately deemed unfit for its intended purpose. The Home Office said the report related to the actions of the previous government and it was committed to achieving better value for taxpayers. This year's Children in Need appeal reaches its climax tonight with a live show on BBC One from 7pm. Among the highlights will be the actor Gary Oldman reading a CBeebies bedtime story.
Thank you, Jane. 9 minutes past seven is the time. The vaccine sceptic Robert Kennedy Jr. for Health and Human Services, a full cabinet post in charge of the whole of America's health infrastructure. Of all the picks Donald Trump has made, this is one that is guaranteed to lead to horror here in the USA among those who are experts in public health, in vaccinations, in scientific method. Many of them have been sharing stories of how the inventions of the pharmaceutical companies have improved the lives of all of us. How crazy it seems to them to be for the incoming administration to pick a fight with Big Pharma. On the other hand, there is a strong sense among many Americans that Big Pharma and Big Food are not always fighting the good fight. And some of what Robert Kennedy has said about drug and foods strikes a chord with them. Donald Trump praised his choice in a speech to supporters last night at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida.
Today I nominated him for, I guess, if you like health and if you like people that live a long time, it's the most important position, RFK Jr. Bobby. And I just looked at the news reports. People like you, Bobby. Don't get too popular, Bobby. Oh. We want you to come up with things and ideas and what you've been talking about for a long time. And I think you're going to do some unbelievable thing. Nobody's going to be able to do it like you.
I've been talking to Dan Diamond, who's the Washington Post national health reporter, a longtime chronicler of RFK's pronouncement. He's been telling me about the man and what he wants to do.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is part of the famous Kennedy family here in the States. He was not a particularly well-known member of the family. He had received some acclaim for his work on the environment. He had mounted a bid, a long-shot campaign for president last year that did break through, that did attract millions of fans. But it was fading earlier this year when he decided to end his campaign and endorse Donald Trump in exchange for the promise of getting a major role overseeing health and food safety here in the States. And it looks like Donald Trump is going to deliver that to him. He has picked him as his nominee for the Health and Human Services Secretary. So overseeing this vast apparatus of the federal government related to healthcare, vaccines, medication, and so on.
And it's obviously vaccines that'll be the most controversial area that he will now be nominally at least in charge of.
Absolutely. There has never been a leader of this agency who has questioned vaccines, let alone been an activist like RFK Jr. RFK Jr. has lobbied lawmakers across the United States, even around the world, about, he says, the dangers of vaccines. He has repeated debunked claims dating back to a debunked Lancet study from the UK, but he has followers who believe that. The members of Congress who are going to be reviewing his nomination do not agree with him on vaccines, but there are other ideas that he has put forward that they do like related to combating chemicals and food, chronic disease, and other things. So we'll have to see if that is where they end up landing, willing to support that.
It's really interesting on those other things, for instance, on ultra-processed foods that a lot of people feel is killing Americans, indeed killing people in the wider West as well, that he mixes stuff that is highly controversial, to put it mildly, often flat out wrong, with things that an awful lot of people will agree with.
That's a great way to put it. If you looked at his agenda, which he is calling Make America Healthy Again, it is a riff off Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan. Kennedy's agenda sounds like what a lot of Democrats would propose. I have interviewed Senator Bernie Sanders, a progressive leader here in the States, a number of times. If I was just looking at the text of what RFK has said on food or on the power of the pharmaceutical industry, it looks a lot like what a Bernie Sanders would say. So on those issues, he has a lot of support, and that helped bring some people to his campaign, even people who don't agree with him on vaccines. They want to see healthier food. They want to see chronic disease go down and other things that are bipartisan.
On the other hand, at the moment, everyone will concentrate, won't they, on the vaccines. And presumably amongst health professionals in the US, this is not just a matter of controversy. They will be saying it will harm people and harm children.
It's not an overstatement to say that for public health professionals, it's a matter of life and death. We know that vaccines have saved lives. We know that it has helped eliminate the risk of disease like polio here in the States and in other developed countries. So to have someone in charge of an agency who doesn't trust vaccines and who might not want to put out certain data on vaccines, RFK Jr. has argued that there isn't enough safety data right now on vaccines, and that's what he's going to focus on, putting out more studies on how vaccines work. But given his prior statements, it's hard to know what he wants to do if he gets confirmed to this role.
Dan Diamond from The Washington Post, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
It's 14 minutes past seven. Data out in the last few minutes shows the UK economy grew between July and September. Fliss is back to tell us more. Fliss.
Yes, well, I mean, it grew, but not by a huge amount. GDP grew by 0.1% in the third quarter of this year, which is lower than expected. And what growth there was powered by the construction sector. That was up 0.8%. Production actually fell by 0.2%. Now, one company that sees a lot of this on the ground is the FTSE 100 real estate giant, Landsec. It has a £10 billion portfolio of apartments, offices and shopping centres across the UK. And it's just reported its own half-year results. Its CEO, Mark Allen, joins me now. Mark, good morning.
Good morning.
So subdued GDP, but your results showed profits before tax of £243 million. So I imagine you're feeling pretty upbeat. What's behind that?
We've seen a continued growth in demand from the people who rent space from us. So that's in major shopping centres and in offices. And that demand is more and more concentrated on the real high quality assets. That's pushing occupancy up. It's pushing rents up, as a result of which we've upgraded our earnings guidance today for this year and for next year. So it really is about the strength of demand for best in class assets.
Now, looking then at that GDP data, quite a big drop off in growth compared to the first half of the year. Does that tally with what you're seeing at Landsec?
I would say overall that makes sense to us. Growth, we know it's a priority for the government, but it's a 3-year project to put in place the conditions for sustainable growth rather than the 3-month project. So what we're seeing is at the very high end, the top end of the market, demand is strong. But I think across the wider market, that's a much more mixed picture. And I think that's what you're seeing in the GDP numbers today.
Well, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says that improving economic growth is at the heart of everything she's seeking to achieve. And she says she's not satisfied with those numbers. She obviously wants far more growth. You've been investing in recent weeks and months. You've taken control of the Bluewater Shopping Centre in Kent and, in fact, Media City here in Salford. Are you going to keep investing?
We will always be seeking to invest in the right opportunities. And for us, that's being very selective about the types of locations and places that we invest in, whether that's in buying existing places or indeed within developing new places. But what we need from the government is leadership in three key areas to drive growth. And that's in infrastructure. It's in improving regulation. And it's in improving the skills across the UK. And in each of those cases, we have significant challenges in front of us now. We've heard the right sorts of things from the government, even as recently as last night with the Mansion House speech around regulating for growth, which is a really welcome thing to hear from any chancellor, but particularly a Labour chancellor. But it's a long process now to actually turn that into reality. And that's what we need to see.
Mark Allen from Landsec, thank you very much indeed.
17 minutes past seven is the time. Thank you, Fliss. What on earth is the point of the COP process if people swan around the world in private jets and get feted by oligarchs who use the get-together to do deals to sell oil and gas? That is what is alleged to be happening, among other things, at COP29 in Azerbaijan. It's left a number of climate experts so exasperated that they've written to the UN to complain. Among them is Johan Rockström, who is professor in Earth System Science at the University of Potsdam in Germany. He's one of the co-authors, one of the initiators of the letter, and is on the line now. Professor, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Good morning.
Why do you feel so strongly about this, and what do you want to change?
Well, the origins of this is actually that we need the UN process more than ever. Science is clear. We have a climate crisis. There's urgency. We have to cut global emissions by 7.5% per year to have any chance of holding the Paris Agreed, the legally binding 1.5 degrees Celsius global warming limit. 30 years of negotiations have actually made very, very significant results. We must celebrate the fact that all the legal text, all the agreements and commitments and promises on methane, on deforestation, on adaptation, on finance, on mitigation, on phasing out fossil fuels have been agreed upon. So what we're suggesting is that now is the time for a reform to move from commitments and promises to action and delivery. So it's not questioning the COP process. On the contrary, we need it more than ever, but we need to move into action mode.
Yeah, but what you're saying is, two things. Number one, you're saying that the current process doesn't work. And number two, you're doing it at a time when the COP is actually happening in Azerbaijan. And that has had a huge effect there. And I wonder whether it is your intention that you actually bring down what is going on in Azerbaijan at the moment. Is it your intention to do something as dramatic as that, to dramatize in a sense what you say is going wrong?
No, actually, this COP reform proposal started over a year ago. We communicated with Simon Steele, the head of the United Nations Framework Convention, over a year ago. We've been communicating very, very clearly that now is the time to turn page, have more accountability, more scientific updates, more finance, and more reporting and hold countries accountable against all the national plans.
Yes, but you've made all of that public during the Azerbaijan process. That's the point, isn't it?
Yes. Well, of course, the world gathers, even almost half of the world's heads of state gather in Azerbaijan. It's a moment when politically this climate negotiations are at the center. It's not so surprising that we at that point want to raise this issue. Let's discuss getting serious about implementing the Paris Agreement, not only talking about filling some gaps that have largely been sorted out already.
It's not just raising the issue, though, is it? It's raising it at this time. And sorry to harp on this point, but it has caused such upset at the climate talks. And we've heard from our climate editor early in the program who is there, that I wonder if it is or is not your intention that in Azerbaijan they stop what they are doing and concentrate on your letter and on thinking about the future.
No, that is not our intent at all. And it's a pure coincidence. And it's, of course, very unfortunate that you have an incoming administration in the US and you have an Argentinian government deciding to withdraw in the midst of the Baku negotiations, which were absolutely completely coincidental. We do not want to interrupt the discussions in Baku. We want Baku discussions to succeed, but we also want them to move into the next phase of implementation of the Paris Agreement.
Professor Johan Rockström, thank you very much for talking to us.
It's 21 minutes past seven. Sir Keir Starmer has hailed the arrest of a Turkish man in Amsterdam airport who's suspected of being a major supplier of small boat equipment to people smugglers as a significant piece of the jigsaw in tackling channel crossings. The arrest was made following a joint operation by the UK's crime agency and Dutch and Belgian police. Well, Anne Lukowiak is a federal prosecutor in Belgium who was involved in this case, and she joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning from Belgium, Katia.
Can you explain to us, if you would, how the arrest came about? Because I believe you identified the suspect 2 years ago. So what happened in the interim?
We could identify him into other investigations, and with the help of the UK colleagues, we could identify him as a Turkish national. And then the next question was how we would arrest him, apprehend him. So sometimes it takes time to find out how we will do it. And at some point, we had information that he might come to the Netherlands. So we already had a joint investigation team between the UK and Belgium, and we had another coordination meeting with the Dutch colleagues to have them on board, and it just happened.
So what does the case tell us about the way European countries are working together to smash the criminal gangs, as UK Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer puts it, those people smuggling gangs? Because the UK, the Netherlands and Belgium were absolutely key in this.
It's not just in this case that we had excellent cooperation or continuous cooperation with the UK. We are really trying through international cooperation to identify and arrest people smugglers for whom migrants mean nothing. So we have this cooperation. It's not always easy because we have different systems to work in, but the will is there and we take our responsibility in this.
Yeah, I mean, the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, says this case does show how important it is for UK crime-fighting agencies to work with international partners. The individual who's arrested, he is believed to be a major supplier of boats and engines to the smugglers operating in Belgium and France. And then some of those small boats, of course, coming over to the UK.
Yeah, well, it's only through international cooperation that we will identify the persons in those criminal organizations, because you have all the countries have information, but you have to put the puzzle together to see that nicknames are corroborating with the name of a person, the phone numbers. And it's just by this international cooperation that we can do that. And it's not where the prosecution is important, is that the person is prosecuted because evidence is put together, and that only goes by international cooperation.
And what will happen when the man who was arrested in Amsterdam airport is extradited to Belgium? When might he face trial?
When, I can't say. It will be at a certain point when the case is finalized with the help of the UK colleagues and the Dutch colleagues. But he will be he's facing charges in Belgium up to 15 years for his role in this phenomenon.
Anne Lukowiak, federal prosecutor in Belgium, thank you very much indeed for your time. And Nick will be picking up many of these issues next week. He's got a special series of programmes from Turkey, Bulgaria and Germany looking at illegal immigration and the impact on European politics.
26 minutes past seven now, time for the sport. Here's Carthy.
Morning, thank you. England had a 3-0 win over Greece last night, with the victory in Athens meaning England can return to the top tier of the UEFA Nations League this weekend if they beat the Republic of Ireland on Sunday. We can speak to the former England goalkeeper. Morning, David James.
Morning, Carthy. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. Hope you are too. England had a pretty demoralising 2-1 defeat to Greece at Wembley last month. Did you feel this 3-0 win was a turnaround or return to form, perhaps?
Yeah, definitely a turnaround. I mean, there's contributing factors from the starting lineup in that game at Wembley. I thought it was a great win. And if it hadn't been for Jordan Pickford in particular, I think it would have been overall a great performance. But England were exposed a few times.
It was a bold move from the interim manager, Lee Carsley, to put the England captain, Harry Kane, on the bench. Was that something that surprised you or not particularly?
I think I always felt that England should win the group, given it is the B league of the Nations League. And therefore, Carsley had the opportunity to experiment a bit. I know there was a lot of injuries as well. But interestingly, when Kane came on, England played and scored, got a couple of goals, didn't they? So his involvement was still crucial for the win. But I thought Carsley did the right thing in experimenting a little bit. We played well with some newly blooded players like Sir Curtis Jones, who scored an absolutely wonderful goal. So, yeah, it was the right decision, I think.
Yeah, and you talked about Jones, who impressed you. Who else impressed you in terms of, you know, you've mentioned a couple of times that this is a slightly different team, perhaps a slightly younger team. Things are moving on with this England squad, aren't they?
They are, yeah. I mean, the start was great. Madueke, I thought, was superb, especially in that first half. Just thinking about it now, Jude Bellingham, I mean, his involvement again was superb. Stuff that you would expect to see against, as say, lower opposition. But I just felt that the overall balance seemed a lot better. Again, I sort of caveat that with Jordan Pickford's impressive display, but there was a lot for England to be positive about going up against Ireland on the weekend.
Yeah, and they will avoid a playoff return to the top tier of the Nations League if England beats the Republic of Ireland on Sunday. You sound pretty confident of what you think about the outcome of that match, I presume, David?
I'm always confident when it comes to England. I have to say they will be up against a very informed Caoimhín Kelleher. A penalty save yesterday as well. Informed for Liverpool, number one at the moment with Alisson out. So, no, it's going to be. I don't think it'll be straightforward, but I'm confident England will do it.
Yeah, good to pick out the keeper, David James. Thank you very much for speaking to me this morning. Well, the Republic of Ireland, with that save as well, had a 1-0 win over Finland, and they are third in that group with England at the top. Scotland faced Croatia tonight. There's commentary of that match on Five Live from 7:45, and Northern Ireland host Belarus at Windsor Park. A few other sports headlines for you. Rory McIlroy is joint top of the leaderboard with Tyrrell Hatton at golf season-ending DP World Tour Championship. And England's men's cricketers have an unassailable 3-0 series lead over West Indies after winning the third T20 by 3 wickets. Racing tips return for the big meeting at Cheltenham. It's 2:55 at Cheltenham, number 7, Fame After the Glory, and 3:30 in number 2, Potter's Charm.
Thanks so much, Carthy. Now, it was an assassination that sent shockwaves around the world.
I know what I am. I know what I am to you.
Brand new drama starring Christopher Eccleston and Simon McBurney.
I am adamant there could be no deliberate intention to offend you here.
I do not believe you.
Yorgi Markov, his life and his infamous death.
It is a story you might have heard before and thought it too preposterous to be anything other than apocryphal.
Now, you seem to think you've been poisoned.
Breaking the Rules, The Markov File, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It did happen. It happened to me.
Tomorrow afternoon at 3.
To the weather. Northern areas mostly cloudy, increasingly breezy. Rain sweeping into northern Scotland by evening.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb in New York and Katia Adler in London. It is 7:30 and time for a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
Donald Trump has nominated the vaccine sceptic and conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be his health secretary. Mr. Kennedy was an independent candidate for the presidency before withdrawing and backing the Trump campaign. He's the latest of several controversial candidates to be put forward by the president-elect, whose nominations may face opposition in Congress. A group of scientists and former political leaders has said the United Nations climate talks are not fit for purpose and need a comprehensive overhaul. The country hosting COP29, Azerbaijan, has been criticised after its president said oil and gas were a gift of God, and an official appeared to try to arrange a meeting to discuss fossil fuel deals. Figures published in the past half hour show economic growth in the UK slowed between July and September compared with the previous quarter. The economy grew by 0.1%, which was less than analysts had predicted. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, said she was not satisfied with the figures. BBC News has found that it's still possible to buy zombie knives and machetes despite a ban on their sale in England and Wales coming into force several weeks ago. The illegal weapons were being advertised on the websites of UK knife retailers. 4 items were purchased and delivered, some of them shipped from abroad. Israel's Attorney General has urged the Prime Minister to reconsider the position of the country's far-right security minister. Gali Baharav Miara said Itamar Ben-Gvir had politicised the police force for his own ends. Mr. Ben-Gvir described her comments as an attempted coup. The government spending watchdog says the Home Office paid £15 million for a derelict prison contaminated with asbestos as it rushed to find accommodation for migrants it wanted to move out of hotels. The National Audit Office says Rishi Sunak's government cut corners and paid more than was needed to acquire the North Eye site in East Sussex.
Jane, thank you. 28 minutes to 8 is the time. Donald Trump told supporters at that gala in his Mar-a-Lago resort last night that the Russia-Ukraine war has got to stop and it would be a priority when he takes office in January. His pick for Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said that America is funding a stalemate war in Ukraine, which needs to be brought to an end. Each of Mr. Trump's top foreign policy appointments have also questioned to some extent the basis of NATO at current spending levels, and they are all sceptical about subsidising Europe's conventional defence. What does it all mean for the future of European security, of our security? Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman reports now from Washington.
As one group of tourists files past, this is Congress, and I'm standing below the gleaming dome of the US Capitol building, shining white in the November sunshine. And this is the very heart of American democracy. Excuse me, guys. Sorry to bother you. I'm from BBC.
Oh, BBC.
Okay. I just wonder if I can ask you, what do you think about taxpayer dollars funding weapons to Ukraine?
I think the amount that we've supported them, might want to ease that one back a little bit, throttle back on that.
I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, you would think they would have made a little more inroads in that war with that kind of money.
Soon, the Senate will be asked to confirm Donald Trump's choices to lead his America First foreign policy. First among them, as Secretary of State, Marco Rubio.
At the end of the day, what we are funding here is a stalemate war, and it needs to be brought to a conclusion.
Who this year voted against U.S. military assistance to Ukraine. Then there's the Trump nominee for Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, who wants to build pressure
on allies who haven't been paying up and ponying up the way they should for this key alliance.
Like the boss, he's a NATO skeptic. And to the White House, without a nod from the Senate, will be the National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz.
Let's move to burden sharing. The United States provided $30 billion in security assistance. The next nearest is Germany at $3.5 billion. UK, less than $3 billion. Is that fair?
The common theme here is hawkish isolationism. All hawks on China, all skeptics on pouring more US treasure into Europe, as they think the Biden team has done in vain in Ukraine. In the Senate, I spoke to Trump loyalist Republican Senator Josh Hawley, who says Washington's allies in Europe might have to fight more of their own battles in future, as America is looking the other way.
The United States has got to focus its attention, our attention geopolitically, on China. We just have to. They're our number one threat. We're the only nation in the world that is able to go toe-to-toe with China. We will assist with the conventional defense of Europe. But we just have to be honest. The United States cannot both lead the conventional defense of Europe and also lead the conventional defense of Asia. We just can't do both of those things. We can't.
The incoming Secretary of State wants to liken Britain, France and Germany to American welfare recipients when it comes to defence, saying the conservative solution is to put them on a work programme. Another Trump ally, Katie McFarland, Deputy National Security Advisor in his first White House, believes it's time for Europe to accept that Ukraine should negotiate.
Ukraine is slowly losing this war. And Russia, as long as energy prices are high, Russia has the windfall profits to pay for this war. And it's a war of attrition.
But there is and has been a principled position that the West has tried to take here, which is about international law, that you don't just go and grab territory and get to keep it just because you're more powerful. Isn't this just going to be an erosion of that really important historical principle?
If you look at how this war came about, and I think you're absolutely right, everything you said about Russia, they're the aggressors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But give me a plan where Ukraine wins. How do you achieve that other than having the United States be militarily involved or NATO being militarily involved? I think President Trump, throughout his career, even before he got into politics, was never a war guy. He's always been someone looking for how do you settle conflict? How do you not go to war?
Well, it tells you something about the scale and the scope of American government. The underground in the Senate is a train, an underground train that runs between the senator's offices and the chamber itself, which we're now on, heading towards the Senate chamber in this time of transition. And at the end of the line, the Democratic senator, John Fetterman.
It's a bad day for Ukraine. It's I'll never understand. I mean, it's been an ongoing war on democracy, and I can't imagine why anyone could turn our back on Ukraine. But that's what America voted for.
Someone else who's watched Washington's foreign policy fluctuate between administrations but is now bracing for severe turbulence is the historian of U.S.-Russia relations, Mary Elise Cerati. She says Trump's approach to NATO remains unpredictable.
He pulls out formally, which I think is unlikely. He just de facto guts it, but NATO can recover in 4 years, or he de facto guts it and NATO cannot recover. And this goes back, again, as a historian, to a larger debate that we used to have in this country. We in the United States are deeply fortunate because in the North we have Canadians, in the South we have Mexicans, and East and West we have fish. In other words, we don't have major hostile powers on our borders. We need to start the territorial defense of the United States on the far side of our oceans, and that means NATO. And yet another way that Trump is breaking with precedent is he has renewed that debate. If NATO falls apart, basically from neglect, then I think we would be in a very, very dangerous position.
The guardrails of Donald Trump's first term, the generals in his cabinet he'd picked, who aligned more closely with the conventional US approach towards Europe, are gone. Those due to run his foreign policy now are ultra-loyalists, and getting his way with the world looks like an easier run this time round.
Jocelyn, we just heard there in Tom Bateman's package that the possibility of NATO falling apart. I mean, now that we know who Donald Trump wants on his top foreign policy and defence team, what do you think this means for Europe that's been angsting about this possibility for ages, and also for the future of NATO, that transatlantic military alliance?
It's interesting. I'm in New York now, but I spent some time in Washington after the election. When you talk to people who are kind of involved in the kind of foreign policy world there, they mostly think that he won't blow up NATO. They mostly think that he is genuinely trying to get the European countries to pay more. And actually that, as you know, is a bipartisan view from the United States. Democrats don't say it rudely and publicly, but they think it behind the scenes and they want action. And if Europe does pony up more money, then the thinking is that in that transactional way that actually he sticks with NATO. And I mean, you know, it's Donald Trump. You can't know. But I think I can tell you the preponderance of opinion at the moment is that that's the case.
Well, certainly all of Europe, but very much Ukraine's hoping that Donald Trump does stick with NATO. What do you think this new team means for Ukraine? Because, of course, Donald Trump said he could end the conflict in 24 hours.
Look, I mean, and he's going to have to end it, because that is a promise. You know, there are sort of four or five key promises that he has made to the American people, and this is unquestionably one of them. The war is going to end, and it will end, most people believe here, in the giving up of some Ukrainian territory to Russia. In a sense, I think the more interesting and the more difficult to plot issue is what happens after that. Does it end with Russia essentially getting all that it wants and with no future security guarantee that's worth the paper it's written on to Ukraine or indeed to other potentially vulnerable European states? Or does it end with some kind of proper organized agreement that there will be more American power used in the future if Russia oversteps the mark, doesn't agree to a decent, as the Americans would see it, end in Ukraine, or indeed attacks another country? And that, I think, at the moment is the unknowable thing that everyone here is trying to work out, and will depend to a large extent, it seems to me, on who in the end has the ear of Donald Trump and can enforce some kind of a sense of direction on the man himself.
Mm. And in the meantime, in the last weeks he has left in the White House, NATO allies are watching to see if Joe Biden gives that green light for Ukraine to use long-range missiles to fire into Russia. For now, Justin in New York, thanks so much. And the time is 19 minutes to 8, and today is the day that Gladiator 2 is out in UK cinemas. And there's a lot of social media debate around actor Paul Mescal's muscles. It's time to tell you also then about a rare Roman knife handle cast in the shape of a gladiator that's been found near Hadrian's Wall in Northumberland and handed over to English Heritage. Dr. Francis McIntosh is the curator for Hadrian's Wall and the North East for English Heritage. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do tell us about the knife. I mean, what does the handle tell us about gladiators at the time and their celebrity status?
So what's wonderful about the knife is it's extremely well preserved. It's around about 6 centimetres tall. It's copper alloy, and it shows a very specific type of gladiator called a secutor, which shows his shield and his helmet, so we're able to identify him. But what's even more exciting is that we can tell that he was a left-handed gladiator. Now, you might think, oh, well, so what? You know, so many people are left-handed. But in the Roman world, being left-handed was considered unlucky. Fighting left-handed was not very common. So we think there's a possibility that this knife handle, the figure on there, is depicting a specific fighter, a specific person, not just a generic executor who's a fighter. And I think if you're purchasing a piece of, you know, memorabilia depicting a specific fighter, it really highlights that sort of fan culture around gladiators. Gladiators could become big celebrities, even though they were slaves and they were the, you know, the lowest of the low in the social class. They could be given gifts, you know, fans would come and watch them practice at their gladiator schools. They could potentially buy their freedom if they earned enough, and really did have that sort of celeb culture similar to some of our sports people today.
It's a real rags to riches tale at the time. Do you think that's why there is still such a huge interest in Gladiator's Day, like these gladiator films show us?
I think so. I mean, today particularly, we love an underdog, don't we? You know, we love sort of a team who's doing really poorly all of a sudden has a, you know, a light bulb moment and becomes, you know, wins the Premier League or something like that. And that's what the gladiators are, aren't they? They're, you know, social outcasts. They have nothing, but they can go into an arena and entertain thousands of people, potentially, you know, win lots of money, win their freedom, become famous. And I think, you know, we love sports today, and you can see that with, you know, sort of the fan culture around that. Gladiatorial combat's a little bit more bloodthirsty than the sports we follow, but you can see the sort of similarities, and people love to be able to cheer people on. And gladiators were well trained, you know, really good physical sort of specimens, and they're displaying that prowess to a crowd who are, you know, wanting their gladiator to win, their favourite.
And just briefly tell us, if we want to see the knife handle, the left-handed gladiator, where can we see it?
So it's going to be on display next summer at Corbridge Roman site up in Northumberland. But we're talking about it now because Bob and Rolf, the divers, have donated the knife handle and all the other objects they found in the river to us, to English Heritage, to care for the future. So we've got this winter to work on them and hopefully pull out a nice exhibition for next summer.
Excellent. Dr. Francis McIntosh, the curator for Hadrian's Wall and the Northeast for English Heritage. Thank you. I look forward to seeing the handle.
7:45 is the time. Coming up in a few minutes, more signs this morning that economic growth in this country is sluggish. So do we, should we look to new arrangements with Europe in order to boost it? But first, thought for the day, and the speaker this morning is Bishop Richard Harris. Good morning.
Good morning, Justin, in America, and good morning, everybody. The president of Azerbaijan, the host of this week's COP29 conference, described his country's natural resources, oil and gas, as a gift from God. This has caused some surprise and dismay. First, it's very unusual for such a specifically religious language to be used in a secular setting. Secondly, because the whole point of COP29 is to speed up the transition away from oil and gas to renewable energy. Now, theists of all kinds would certainly affirm that natural resources are a gift of God. But that itself doesn't tell us if and how they're to be used. Coal might have been a gift to fire the Industrial Revolution, but the right thing to do with that gift now is to leave it in the ground. Behind the great drive to save our planet from destruction and to preserve species that are dying out is a profound but hidden theological truth. The value of creation in and for itself, and the preciousness of every species within it. When I was a boy, there was a field next door to our school that seemed full of fluttering butterflies all summer long. Indeed, so many were there that we thought nothing of trying to make a collection of them. Now, with the terrible decline in their numbers, we delight to see a single one. It seems rare and precious, of value in and for itself as a work of singular mystery and beauty. And in that connection, there was one really good story this week. 35 years ago, a farm was accidentally rewilded. Now it's become the home to many threatened species, including turtle doves, warblers, 11 bat species, orchids and butterflies. £1.5 million has just been raised by crowdfunding to purchase it for the Wildlife Trust. On a larger scale, The drive to stop the planet heating up by reducing carbon dioxide emissions isn't just to prevent the increasing number of adverse weather conditions. It is to make sure the Earth is here and habitable for future generations. And the implication of this is that life on Earth is the most precious gift of all. R.S. Thomas has a poem in which a man looks down on a valley, sees a stream shining, and hears children's voices. Although he's old and death is near, he notices the herbs growing in his garden and a kestrel flying by. There are scents in the wind. It ends with the words, "It is well," and the poem is called simply, "Good." It's an echo of the wonderful affirmation that runs through the story of creation in the first book of the Bible. God saw what he'd made. It was very good.
And that was Thought for the Day with Bishop Richard Harris. It brings us to 12 minutes to 8.
Brexit is one of the main reasons the UK economy isn't performing as it could, as it should. That was the message of a major speech last night by the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey. Now, he was addressing an audience of bankers, as well as the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, at the annual Mansion House dinner. With Brexit still politically a delicate topic, Mr. Bailey was careful to emphasise this was his professional, not personal opinion. But he's not alone in pointing the finger at Brexit as one of a number of strains on the UK economy. Now, all of this, as the Chancellor says this morning, she's not satisfied by the latest growth figures for the UK economy, a sluggish 0.1% of growth between July and September. Well, I will be speaking in a moment to Liam Byrne, Labour MP and Chair of the Business and Trade Select Committee of the House of Commons. But first, Sir John Gee, former Deputy Governor for Financial Stability at the Bank of England. Good morning.
Morning.
Now, bearing in mind Russia's invasion of Ukraine, COVID, inflation, how can we accurately quantify the Brexit effect on the UK economy?
Well, it's obviously extremely difficult, and the models we have, economic models, aren't very good at measuring big changes, big shocks. But our main institutions have had a go, and the National Institute, for example, has estimated that it'll lower GDP in Britain by 5 to 6% in due course, of which perhaps 2/3 has already happened. And that's broadly in line with the Office of Budget Responsibility. That's the official government forecaster, came up with a number of around 4%. So that's the consensus among the experts.
And Andrew Bailey said the UK should now watch for opportunities to have a closer relationship with the EU in trading terms while respecting the result of the Brexit referendum. So that could mean rejoining the single market. It could mean rejoining the customs union. The Prime Minister has ruled those options out. But what difference would it make to the UK economy?
Well, I mean, the Chancellor too talked about easing relations with Europe and specifically ruled out again rejoining the single market or the customs union. So I think those are off the table. And what we're talking about is, can we get some deals around the edges which reduce the barriers to trade? They've talked about aligning standards on veterinary standards, for example, to allow freer trade in that sphere. We would like to have agreements to recognise mutually recognised professional qualifications, for example. And there are a whole series of edge issues, sectoral issues, where we might be able to make a minor difference. Of course, we have to persuade Europe to do that. We reached a deal with them which didn't have these easements in it. And so that's not going to be easy. But that's the sort of thing that we should be going for. In terms of what difference will it make, well, it depends how well we do it. If we could in due course get close to joining the customs union, I think that would be a major help, because it would mean people could invest in Britain, and it's investment that we're looking for. They could invest in Britain in the knowledge that they could freely export into Europe, as they did before Brexit.
Sir John Gee, former Deputy Governor for Financial Stability at the Bank of England. Of course, the closer you get to the EU, the more you do have to align with EU rules. Liam Byrne, Labour MP and Chair of the Business and Trade Select Committee in the House of Commons. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can I ask you first about today's news that the UK economy only grew by an anemic 0.1% between July and September? I mean, how far was that down to the gloomy words we heard from the Prime Minister and Rachel Reeves in the lead up to the budget? Because, I mean, it was in August we heard from Keir Starmer that there would be a very painful budget ahead.
I think that today's growth figures are really the culmination of some really long-term problems with the British economy. Ultimately, everybody knows that we need to raise the investment rate in the British economy, and we've just not been investing enough in infrastructure, in skills, in innovation for a long period of time. And I'm afraid that catches up with you, especially if you're now in this new world where so much of our trade is either wrapped in red tape. And now we have this new risk of rising tariffs too. So we're in sort of quite a difficult position at the moment, and we're going to need some pretty bold and some pretty quick measures from the government.
Mm. Well, I mean, we were just hearing from Sir John Gieve that because the government has ruled out rejoining the customs union or the single market with the EU, that they're sort of very small changes, very small getting closer to the EU's, that could be done. I mean, why not go for the changes that would achieve a major, not a minor difference if you're going to do it? You voted Remain, didn't you? I mean, is that what Keir Starmer believes but feels politically he can't go back on when it comes to Brexit, do you think?
Well, I think the Labour Party has just made quite a big promise to the British people that it isn't going to join the single market and the customs union. And so I don't think there is the political space for just simply doing a 180 on that. But the truth is that there is a myriad of things that we could be doing to cut down the friction on our trade with Europe. And as we face a situation where friction with the US might be about to go up, it's really important that friction with the EU goes down. Now, when we were in Brussels earlier in the year, we saw lots of potential around an economic and security deal. We saw lots of little things that would make a big deal, whether it's health security or mutual recognition of qualifications or trusted trader schemes or connecting vehicle registration databases. But the big prize, of course, that's available in the short term is aligning standards on the agri-food business. We think that could give you a £3.5 billion boost to exports pretty quick.
Yeah,
that's a prize worth shooting for.
It is the agriculture sector that has suffered very much after Brexit. In particular, we know that services have suffered less actually than was expected. But there has to be a quid pro quo, isn't there, with the EU? And what the EU is pushing for is a youth mobility scheme. So freedom for EU students to study and then work for a limited amount of time in the UK after their studies and vice versa. Now, the government has repeatedly poured cold water over the idea. Is that a mistake?
I personally think it is. I mean, at the end of the day, trade is built on trust, and trust is built on people knowing each other. And if we want the UK economy and the EU to draw closer together over the years to come, as I think lots of us want to, then a sensible investment would be making sure that our young people get to travel around Europe and young Europeans get to travel around Britain. Now, I understand the political pressure to bring immigration numbers down. I was the immigration minister for 2 years, but there has got to be a sensible place here where we can allow young people to understand their common European inheritance. And by the way, I would couple
The short-term worker scheme. And what about other trade deals? I mean, you mentioned the United States. It's going to be tricky with Donald Trump in the White House. We've said repeatedly on the programme today, he is unpredictable. He has threatened blanket tariffs of 10 to 20% on all imports. Now, this would affect the UK as well. It'll massively affect the EU. It's the biggest trade partner. Do you think the UK has to make a choice, head towards a trade deal with the US? Donald Trump has dangled the possibility at times, or getting closer to the EU?
So it's really hard to see the pathway to a complete free trade deal with the United States. I mean, the Congress, which is important on trade, wants to see a grand bargain on trade that includes agriculture. But the reality is, a deal on agriculture with the United States is going to throw British farmers under the bus. And that would really, I think, prevent us drawing closer with the EU on agri-food. And I think that prize, the closer deal with the EU, is much closer and much more significant. But we do face a really challenging situation now where you've got a lot of friction with EU trade. And now the prospect of rising tariffs with the United States, you could now see getting on for 2/3 of UK exports facing real problems. So the government has got to sort of move quite quickly now and begin gripping this and try and get, I think, an economic security deal with the United States that, you know, persuades them to avoid putting tariffs on us. But then we've got to start cutting down that friction and cutting down that red tape with EU trade too.
Liam Byrne, Labour MP and Chair of the Business and Trade Select Committee in the House of Commons, thank you.
Couple of minutes to wait. Let us hear what's going to be on this evening's Any Questions, because Alex Forsyth can join us. Morning, Alex.
Good morning, Justin. Tonight we are in Sheffield in a week where there is so much our audience might want to talk about. The assisted dying bill, COP29 taking place in Azerbaijan, what follows the resignation of Justin Welby. Our panel will be poised for whatever comes up. We have Sarah Champion, the chair of the International Development Committee, the Conservative peer, Lord Matthew Elliott, Julia King, engineer and chair of the Climate Change Adaptation Committee, and Catherine Pepinster, journalist and writer on religion. We are live as ever at 8 PM here on Radio 4. I do hope you can join us.
And it's time now with us for the weather forecast, Simon King.
Katia, thanks so much indeed. Good morning. We have got, once again, lots of cloud out there this morning with some mist, some fog and a bit of drizzle as well. Not everywhere, though. For some parts, we have got some clear skies, and that's where it's quite chilly in southwest England, across Wales, the Midlands and northeast England. But let's start off the forecast today in eastern and southeast England, where it's a cloudy start today. But by late morning into lunchtime, there'll be some sunny spells developing, staying largely sunny through the afternoon with highs of 9 to 13 Celsius. Southwest England through the Midlands, we've got some areas of mist and fog with some clear skies, so a chilly start. Mist and fog should tend to clear away by mid to late morning, and there'll be lots of sunshine into the afternoon with highs of 9 to 13. For Wales, northwest and northeast England, cloudy for many this morning, again some mist and fog, but some clearer skies in northeast England. Now the mist and fog will clear away and there'll be some sunshine into the afternoon across parts of Wales especially, but for northeast England, where you've got some sunshine this morning, there will be a bit more cloud later on and temperatures of 9 to 12 degrees. Across northeast Scotland, quite clear this morning, there'll be some sunshine into the afternoon, but elsewhere across Scotland and Northern Ireland, quite cloudy, staying cloudy with some rain moving its way into the far northwest later and highs of 11 to 14.
Simon, thank you. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday the 15th of November. The headlines. The Chancellor has said she's not satisfied with figures showing UK economic growth has slowed. Donald Trump has chosen the anti-vaccine campaigner Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be his health secretary. And climate experts have told the United Nations that its COP talks need a comprehensive overhaul.
And here in America, Donald Trump's spoken to his closest supporters at a gala in his Mar-a-Lago resort. He has praised many of the people he's picked for his top team, including Elon Musk, who he said was very high IQ. I've been talking to the Republican strategist, Mike Murphy, about the Trump-Musk bromance.
Elon Musk and Donald Trump are two tomcats in the same pillowcase. So I don't think it'll last.
The BBC News read this morning by Jane Steele.
Economic growth slowed in the 3 months to September, with the first estimate suggesting a rise in GDP of just 0.1% in the quarter compared with the previous 3 months. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who's put growth at the heart of her plans, said she was not satisfied with the figures. Here's our chief economics correspondent, Darshini David.
After a marked bounce back from 2023's recession in the first half of the year, the economy's recovery lost momentum over the summer. September was a poor month for manufacturing and services in particular, as businesses battled higher costs and perhaps nerves ahead of October's budget. Allow for population changes and the figures suggest income or GDP per head slipped between July and September and was no higher than a year ago. Economists expect the growth outlook to remain fairly patchy. While the budget will boost public spending, official forecasts predict that will come at the expense of consumer spending and business investment due to tax rises. The Chancellor admits she is not satisfied with this performance. Last night, she echoed comments from the Governor of the Bank of England in saying the UK must build closer ties with the EU as she looks for ways to boost prosperity.
Donald Trump has nominated the prominent vaccine sceptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health in his incoming White House administration. Mr. Kennedy, a member of America's most famous political family, had been an independent candidate for the presidency before withdrawing and backing the Trump campaign. He has a record of promoting conspiracy theories. Last night, the president-elect addressed supporters at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, as our North America editor Sarah Smith reports.
In the longest speech we've heard from Donald Trump since election night, he celebrated what he called the biggest political victory in 129 years. And he praised his nominee for health secretary, saying Robert Kennedy Jr. wanted to make people healthy.
We want you to come up with things and ideas and what you've been talking about for a long time, and I think you're going to do some unbelievable thing. Nobody's going to be able to do it like you, and boy, does he feel it in his heart.
Mr. Kennedy is a divisive choice to be in charge of public health because he's a vocal vaccine skeptic who's promoted debunked theories that link inoculations with childhood autism. He's also said he wants to get rid of fluoride in drinking water because he believes it lowers children's IQs. Mr. Kennedy will also try to take on the food industry, which is not used to being under attack from Republicans. He wants stricter regulations on ultra-processed food. There's continuing controversy over Mr. Trump's choices for other posts, including Congressman Matt Gaetz as Attorney General and Fox News TV host Pete Hegseth as Defense Secretary. All these nominations will need to be approved by the Senate, where some Republican lawmakers have already expressed deep reservations. So this could turn into a battle of wills between Congress and President Trump, and a test of just how powerful the incoming president really is.
The tech billionaire Elon Musk, who's been appointed an advisor to Donald Trump, is reported to have met Iran's ambassador to the United Nations. The New York Times says the pair spoke for more than an hour, focusing on how to diffuse tension between Iran and the US. Neither Mr. Trump's team nor Iranian officials at the UN have confirmed whether a meeting took place. A group of scientists and former political leaders has said the United Nations climate talks are not fit for purpose and need a comprehensive overhaul. The country hosting COP29, Azerbaijan, has been criticised after its president said oil and gas were a gift of God, and an official appeared to try to arrange a meeting to discuss fossil fuel deals. In a letter to the UN, the experts say countries should not host climate conferences if they don't support the phasing out of energy from fossil fuels. One of the signatories, Johann Rockström of the University of Potsdam in Germany, told us future summits needed to focus on implementing existing agreements.
We must celebrate the fact that all the legal texts, all the agreements and commitments and promises on methane, on deforestation, on phasing out fossil fuels had been agreed upon. So what we're suggesting is that now is the time for a reform to move from commitments and promises to action and delivery. So it's not questioning the COP process. On the contrary, we need it more than ever, but we need to move into action mode.
Human rights groups have accused the Azerbaijani government of cracking down on environmental activists. This is the third year in a row that the country hosting the COP talks has been accused of oppression. Here's our climate and science reporter Esme Stallard.
Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have reported what they say is a worrying trend in arrests of environmental activists and researchers since Azerbaijan was selected last year to host COP29. One of the estimated 300 prisoners, Anna Mamaldi, was arrested in April on charges of smuggling after he co-founded an organisation calling for the government to do more to align its policy with the Paris Climate Agreement. Just a few months earlier, the government in Baku had announced it was planning to expand oil and gas operations. The United Arab Emirates and Egypt, who hosted previous COP climate summits, faced similar criticisms for their treatment of civil society organisations. Human rights groups have said there needs to be a review of how the host countries for COP are selected. The Azerbaijani government says it holds no political prisoners.
BBC News has found that it's still possible to buy zombie knives and machetes weeks after the government banned them in England and Wales. The weapons were advertised on the websites of knife retailers in the UK. Some of them were shipped from abroad. Our correspondent Dan Johnson reports.
New restrictions came into force in September, banning the manufacture, sale and possession of zombie-style knives. These are defined as a blade more than 8 inches long with a sharp-pointed end, a sharp edge and one additional feature, a serrated edge, holes in the blade, spikes or multiple sharp points. We found knives matching that description on the websites of British knife retailers. One initially confirmed our order, then said they could no longer sell the weapons. Three others fulfilled our orders and sent us illegal knives. Two of them appear to have been shipped from overseas. Border Force is responsible for intercepting prohibited weapons entering the country, but not every package gets checked. Commander Stephen Clayman from the National Police Chiefs Council said the ban was having a positive impact, but he conceded there was more to do. The Home Office is already reviewing the online availability of knives, and earlier this week, a consultation was launched on the banning of ninja swords.
Israel's Attorney General has urged the Prime Minister to reconsider the position of the country's far-right security minister. Gali Baharav Miara said Itamar Ben-Gvir had politicised the police force for his own ends. Mr. Ben-Gvir described her comments as an attempted coup. The government spending watchdog says the Home Office paid £15 million for a derelict prison contaminated with asbestos as it rushed to find accommodation for migrants it wanted to move out of hotels. The National Audit Office says Rishi Sunak's government paid more than was needed to acquire the North Eye site in East Sussex. Will Vernon has the details.
The report from the spending watchdog will be an uncomfortable read for government officials. It says the Home Office cut corners and made a series of poor decisions to hastily approve the purchase of North Eye. It claims the previous government's promise to end the use of hotels to house asylum seekers created political pressure to acquire new sites quickly. This led to ministers handing over more than £15 million for North Eye, more than double what the previous owners paid just 1 year earlier. And officials who approved the purchase were not told about the additional £20 million needed to clean up the asbestos-ridden facility. In a statement, the Home Office said the report related to the actions of the previous government and it remains committed to achieving better value for the taxpayer.
After nearly 40 years of work, the French Academy has finished the new edition of the Definitive French Dictionary. But its relevance is already being questioned because it's taken so long to compile. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield has been thumbing through it.
Founded in 1635, it would be an understatement to say that the Académie Française is having difficulties keeping up with the pace of the modern age. When its wise men and women, known as the Immortals, first started work on this ninth edition, it was 1986, and no one had dreamed of the internet or smartphones and the way linguistic and cultural change would be so vastly accelerated. The Immortals kept plodding along at the rate of one letter a year. The result now is a new edition replacing the 1935 one, which has certainly been praised, but which critics say is already out of date. While online and commercial French dictionaries are reacting with lightning speed to neologisms and borrowings, this official compendium of the language is too slow to include them. Its new words are new words from a previous generation. It has yuppie, for example, but not TikToker.
Hugh Schofield reporting.
8:10 is the time. It has been a wild ride. When I arrived in the USA more than a fortnight ago, there was real optimism among Democratic supporters that all would be well for Kamala Harris. Then came the election where she lost ground compared with Biden in 2020, right around the nation. A nation that moved to the right, a move powered by young people, by men, and in particular by a fall-off in support for the Democrats among black and Hispanic voters. The causes that seemed to drive support for Donald Trump were economic, ending inflation, but also securing the southern border and ending wars, too, in the Middle East and in Europe. That was the mandate, and now comes the Trump interpretation of the mandate in the form of the people he chooses for the top job. Some, like Marco Rubio for the State Department, surprise no one, but some, at the end of this first full week of transition team work, have caused eyebrows to be raised and alarm bells to be sounded, even within the Republican Party. Let us start with our North America editor, Sarah Smith, on Donald Trump's appearance last night on stage at Mar-a-Lago in buoyant mood.
Self-congratulatory, I think, would be the way to put it, and celebrating what he describes as his historic win. And, you know, it was a very convincing victory, and shouting out to all of the people in the room whom he had nominated to join his cabinet. And it feels as though he is deliberately going out of his way to be controversial with the people that he's choosing to put into the cabinet. Robert Kennedy Jr., obviously a famous vaccine skeptic, is an interesting choice for health secretary. But you've got people like Matt Gaetz, a Republican congressman. He's nominated to be attorney general, somebody who has actually been under investigation for sex trafficking and drug taking and resigned from the House of Representatives almost the instant he was nominated. It would appear simply so that the Ethics Committee report into him can't be published. He, of course, denies any of the wrongdoing, and it doesn't stop there. Controversial Republican Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, who used to be a Democrat, who many people think is far too sympathetic towards not just Russia, but also Bashar al-Assad in Syria when she defended him after using chemical weapons. These are choices that are almost daring Congress to deny him. Every cabinet member has to be approved by the Senate, and he's choosing people that even with 53 senators, it's going to be quite difficult to get them through.
Do we know that? I mean, is there chatter already behind the scenes from Republican politicians who are nervous about these choices, or is it that Trump is so powerful at the moment that he can just do what he wants?
Well, so yes, there are Republican senators who will have a vote on his cabinet choices, saying that they are deeply concerned, most particularly about Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, and more than three of them. But will they have their arms twisted? Will he find a way to get his choices through? This is being set up as a test of strength, it feels like, between the White House and the Senate. Can he force the Senate leader to go into recess to allow him to make recess appointments that don't need to be confirmed? Or can he get a majority of Republican senators to vote for his choices, even though you hear people saying that they're completely unqualified, deeply unsuitable, and some people are really angry about the way in which he's going about making these choices. But if he can get this through, well, then won't that show really who is king of the hill? But of course, he's taking a risk that he may lose one or two of them along the way. But then, of course, maybe you choose somebody as controversial as Matt Gaetz to be your Attorney General, and then whoever you come up with next, well, they'll sail through, because no matter how controversial they might be, they've got nothing on him.
That was Sarah Smith talking to me earlier. It's worth saying here in New York this morning that the New York Post, which is a punchy tabloid, often very supportive of Donald Trump, is not at all supportive of the RFK pick for health secretary. Donald Trump won on promises, it says, to fix the economy, the border and soaring global disorder. His team needs to focus on delivering change on those fronts, not spend energy having to defend crackpot theories or trying to control RFK Jr.'s mouth. So the big question at the end of this week is whether Donald Trump has overreached himself. Do some of his choices like RFK Jr. for the health brief, frighten the horses to an extent that chaos ensues even before they get going? Mike Murphy is an anti-Trump Republican strategist. He ran the campaigns of figures like John McCain and Arnold Schwarzenegger. We started when I talked to him on the anti-vaccine campaigner RFK Jr., who has been picked as health secretary.
Well, most of the serious people around health policy behind closed doors in both parties think he's barking mad. You know, so yes, I think he has overreached. To have an anti-vaxxer and somebody who is not that sure science is real to have that job. There's a quiet opposition brewing about some of these worst appointments, including RFK.
Does that mean, do you think, that there is a really serious chance that he and perhaps Matt Gaetz, who's up for Attorney General, another highly controversial person, that they actually won't get through?
Yeah, I think the chances are fairly high that Matt Gaetz and also Tulsi Gabbard, who is the most unqualified person for Director of National Intelligence ever, I heard today there are at least seven Republican votes against both of them. So they're both in trouble, and I would not be surprised if RFK is in trouble. A lot of people think the strategy from the Trump side here is to flood the zone with a lot of these loyalty first, qualifications last appointees, and just see how many get through. On the theory, if they swarm like this, sure, a couple of the most egregious ones won't make it, but they still get a lot of the middle people who might have been controversial on their own, but they're kind of lost in the crowd of madness.
Because we think of Trump being immensely powerful now, and obviously he is, and you've got both houses of Congress supporting him, or with his members in majorities, Republicans in majorities. But of course, in the House, they face an election again in 2 years, and quite a few Republican senators will as well. I just wonder what your take is on kind of how the balance of power works out now.
Yes, it's very hard in our system in the House if you don't have a fairly sizable majority, because you get these rump groups of your own party that spin away and hold you up. So if the Republicans wind up 5, 6, 7 seats, they can govern, but it'll be fragile. The House is an interesting animal. Unlike the Senate, where the minority has power, if you're in the minority party, in the House, the majority is the dictator of the body. There will be, behind the scenes in the leadership there, great fear and caution, trying to protect that majority, which historical averages say is extremely fragile.
And talking of a new era, just a wider thought about the lessons in all of this for the Democrats, that the dust from the election itself has settled. Are they taking any lessons? You are, of course, now a supporter of theirs, though you're still a Republican. But do you think they're going in the right directions when it comes to a look at what happened and a thought about the future?
I think they're trying to. They tend to be a party in their inside world driven by identity politics. And they got a hard lesson that out in the electorate, they've lost the working class vote in many places. So they have major changes to make. There's a huge debate raging on. And I think one thing to watch is the battle over who will be the generalissimo of the midterm attempted comeback. Will it be Rahm Emanuel from Chicago, who's a tough, savvy, attack first, apologize later operator? Or will it be somebody more from the status quo of the identity coalition they've run unsuccessfully? Maybe Stacey Abrams of Georgia, who had run for Senate and narrowly lost. So the battle lines are drawing for a bit of a civil war in the Democratic Party, but they're taking it very seriously. I don't know if they have the right outcome. Their record of picking the right leadership is shaky. But, you know, we have an old joke here. Nothing focuses the mind like a hanging in the morning. So the stakes couldn't be higher for the Democrats to get this right.
Because there are people who say, aren't there, about the Democratic Party, that it is now so controlled by interest groups who have these identity issues at their core, that actually the idea that they just kind of snap back to a Clinton or indeed to an Obama is unrealistic. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think it's a fair argument, but there's also a recognition they got to change their internal dynamics, because what has happened is the political incentives inside the politics of the party. And, you know, we have an open primary system where millions of people can vote. So the activists have a big power, and it is small d democratic. Those incentives tend to work against the incentives you need to start winning swing states and win elections. So this is kind of like an old labor, new labor fight about winnability or sing the old emotional songs. And there's a full battle going on, and we're going to be all watching it quite closely.
Turning back to Donald Trump, this relationship with Elon Musk, which obviously was something before the election, maybe helped win the election for Trump, but is huge now. The Iranians saying that their ambassador at the United Nations had a meeting with Elon Musk, etc., and Trump himself talking about Musk a lot, and Musk obviously being there when appointments are being made. Does that last, do you think?
I actually believe that Elon Musk and Donald Trump are two tomcats in the same pillowcase. So I don't think it'll last. They're both solo acts. And Elon is a driving force, but he's not sophisticated in government. And it's quite likely that he'll quickly get frustrated. I mean, you don't bark orders and have things happen, which he's used to in a company he owns. So he'll walk into the agriculture department and say, why do we have, you know, thousands and thousands of land agents? We can do it all with drones, fire all the land agents. Then 100 bureaucrats are going to pop up to say, it doesn't work that way. You can't fire them. And the House Ag Committee will appropriate the money, and we're seeing in 10 years. So he's going to have the most frustrating version of yes minister ever, I think, when he starts trying to bark orders. And he's not a long patience guy. And Trump has a huge ego and doesn't like other stars. So it's all love right now. Give it 150 days and we'll see where we are.
Mike Murphy, thank you very much.
It's 21 minutes past eight. How do we balance allowing young people access to social media, which keeps them connected with friends and can be a key source of information for them, with protecting youngsters from cyberbullying, harmful content and more online. It's a subject, of course, that not just the UK is grappling with. You have governments, parents, child protection agencies the world over thinking about it. And Australia has announced it's pressing ahead with a social media ban for the under 16s and that it's putting the onus on social media platforms as well as device manufacturers to keep young people safe. Julie Inman-Grant is Australia's Online Safety Commissioner.
I will be asking each sector of the technology industry, from the device manufacturers to the app stores, to the ISPs and the search engines, to make sure that they're putting safeguards in place to protect children from harmful content like pornography, self-harm, and disordered eating material, so that there are safety protections built in up and down the stack, so there isn't a single point of failure, if you will.
Here in the UK, Josh McAllister is a Labour MP bringing forward a private member's bill on online safety. I spoke to him just a bit earlier and I asked him about his thoughts on Australia's approach.
I think the fact that they're proposing it speaks to something that's happening all around the world, which is governments waking up to concerns that parents, teachers and actually children themselves have of the effects of excess screen time, doom scrolling, and the fact that it's displacing a huge amount of time that kids used to spend in real life interacting with people, now spent on their devices.
Social media companies aren't thrilled, even though you say governments around the world are looking into this. In Australia, they describe this proposed ban as a 20th century response to a 21st century challenge. You also have experts in the field of technology and child welfare, and they say the 16-year age limit is too blunt an instrument to address risks effectively.
Well, looking back to the 20th century, there were a couple of debates that we had here in the UK, including issues like car safety, where we spent years and years debating things like seatbelt measures. And I think this is the equivalent of the seatbelt measure. And when I say this, I mean generally looking at how to put protections in place and some collective rules in place for how we support children to interact with social media and use their smartphones. And in those debates, industry often took a very expected position of opposing changes. But I do think the message to tech companies here in the UK, as we look to make different changes, should be that there's a first mover advantage. If companies can get ahead of this and act responsibly, there will be rewards from consumers and we can then harness and make the most of technology here in the UK.
Your bill also, you know, wants the age of internet adulthood, if you like, to be raised from 13, which it is at the moment in the UK, to 16.
I'm not proposing to ban social media for under 16s, but I am putting forward a number of measures that would, as you say, make it much less addictive for children using smartphones and social media under the age of 16 and shift their time away from the 21 hours on average that a 12-year-old is spending a week on their smartphones to actually freeing them up so that it improves their mental health, their sleep and their learning.
Instagram, for example, it's due to complete the switch to its teen accounts. It announced that introduction in September, and they're going to apply in the UK, the US, Australia and Europe. I mean, even if that's not good enough for you, do you think this signals political pressure is working on these platforms?
I do think it does, actually. And I welcome the fact that Meta have made that change. I've looked into some of the details of it, and I think it takes some very modest steps forward that gives parents a bit more control, protects children and helps them switch off from social media a bit more easily. I want us to go quite a lot further. And one of the ways of doing that here in the UK would be to raise the age at which a child is able to give their permission for data sharing from 13 to 16. That would have the effect of making it much harder for tech companies to use children's data to feed algorithms that then feed stuff back to children that is very, very addictive and hard to get away from.
What Australia is looking at is putting the onus of protection very much on social media platforms, but also device manufacturers. Do you want the government to push harder?
I do want the government to push harder, and that's why I'm putting forward a series of measures in a private member's bill, and I'm working with the Labour government to try and get their support for those measures. My bill will come forward for a second reading in March, and so there's quite a few more months really between where we are now and that date, and my hope is that I can persuade ministers that this is these are a set of actions that are worth taking and that they'll work.
So it sounds like the government is giving time for your bill to get backing, to get good backing.
They're open-minded. So I think they recognise, ministers certainly recognise that this is an issue and a concern for parents. And whilst the Online Safety Act is, you know, a very positive piece of legislation for addressing serious harms like violent images and really inappropriate content, what it doesn't do is really anything to challenge and tackle the rise in addictive by design features on smartphones and social media.
Josh McAllister, Labour MP, thank you so much indeed.
27 minutes past eight to the sport and Carthy.
Morning. Football headlines to start. After all the talk of players withdrawing from the England squad, England did have an emphatic 3-0 win over Greece in Athens in the UEFA Nations League. The Republic of Ireland are in the same group. They had a 1-0 victory over Finland. Scotland face Croatia tonight, and there's commentary of that match on 5 Live from 7:45, while Northern Ireland host Belarus at Windsor Park. Rory McIlroy is joint top of the leaderboard with Tyrrell Hatton at golf's season-ending DP World Tour Championship. Both golfers are on 5 under par after day one in Dubai. Now to tennis, and the British number one, Katie Bolter, has had a breakthrough season to reach a career-high world ranking of number 24. Bolter and her Olympics doubles partner, Heather Watson, are alongside Emma Raducanu and others in the squad as Great Britain take on Germany in the team competition, the Billie Jean King Cup, today.
To actually be able to be in an outside of an individual event, playing in a team event with all the girls here, we've got full support staff and everyone is so incredible. And to surround myself with people like that, it really does push me on myself. And yeah, I feel like I'm learning a lot of new things, good and bad, I'm sure. Everything's been really fun. Being with the girls it's a privilege because we really don't get that much chance to be with them and competing and playing for them, I guess.
And even getting to this point is significant. You and Emma Raducanu led the British team to victory in qualifying in France. Did the manner of that win on clay, coming from behind, help the team build towards these finals?
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't say I'm a veteran on the team. I'd say I've been around for a while. We've come a long way. We've come a seriously long way. And obviously France was a massive one and it was a pivotal point. You know, I mean, we're playing on a surface that personally I'm not that comfortable on, and somehow we found a way to win. And Emma played incredibly those 2 days. And I think as a team, we really came together and, you know, we managed to do the tough task.
You mentioned, I won't say the older, but you're experienced. You prioritised the Olympics this summer. Is there anything from that experience that could help you as the British number one? You're leading this team at the Billie Jean King Cup.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously very proud to say I'm an Olympian. It's something I wanted to check off my list my whole entire life. I learned so much that week, obviously being around the guys as well as the girls, Andy's last one. So I think I was stepping back and watching everyone and seeing how much I could learn from them. But personally for me, Hev and I playing doubles there, I can't tell you how much fun I had on the tennis court and how much pride I had playing with the GB flag on, and the atmosphere was one of the best I've ever played in front of, and this emulates that a lot.
It has been such a successful year for you personally. 2 titles, you're into the world's top 25 for the first time in your career. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
Has your belief in yourself changed over this year?
This has been a really impactful year for me. I've gone through some really good moments. I've gone through some really tough moments as well, but overall, looking back on it, I really feel like I've consolidated myself inside the top 50 comfortably. And now it's time to push on. You know, I really believe that I can get to a certain ranking, and probably not going to share that now because I don't want to put a target on my back. But I have my goals, and this year has really shown me and given me the confidence that my level's there. And obviously to have 2 titles next to my name, you know, I honestly don't play tennis just to make the numbers. I want to win titles. I want to get my ranking up. So, you know, those things mean a lot to me, and they're in prized possession in my lounge right now. Yeah, I think it's something I'm definitely going to reflect on after this week. It is massive ticks in the right direction, and I'm really trying to push on for next year.
Katie Bolter, thank you. Good luck against Germany.
Thanks so much.
And you can watch Great Britain against Germany from 4 o'clock on the BBC iPlayer and BBC Sport app. England's men's cricketers have an unassailable 3-0 series lead over West Indies after winning the third T20 by 3 wickets. And the racing tips return for the big meeting at Cheltenham, 2:55, number 7, Fame After the Glory, and also at Cheltenham, 3:30, number 2, Potter's Charm.
Thanks so much, Cathy. This weekend, the nation's cookery queries and mine are answered.
Join me, Jay Rayner, as I open the doors on a new series of The Kitchen Cabinet. I've assembled an expert panel to answer all your food and cooking questions.
Do you want Thai spicy or English spicy? And I said, I'll have Thai spicy, please. She put in about 6 or 7 of these teeny tiny little green chilies and it nearly blew my head off.
We're taking The Kitchen Cabinet to Wolverhampton, Hitchin and Dorchester. Plus, we're starting with a special episode celebrating World Children's Day.
My question is, favourite pasta, with sauce or without sauce?
What's the best burger you have ever had?
The Kitchen Cabinet with me, Jay Rayner, is on Saturday mornings at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
To the weather, northern air is mostly cloudy, increasingly breezy, rain sweeping into northern Scotland by evening.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb in New York and Katia Adler in London. It's 28 minutes to 9 and time for a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has said she's not satisfied with figures showing economic growth in the UK has slowed. The economy grew by just 0.1% in the 3 months to September compared with the previous quarter. Donald Trump has nominated the well-known vaccine sceptic and conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be his health secretary. Addressing supporters last night, Mr. Trump described Mr. Kennedy as a great mind. Scientists and former political leaders say the UN climate talks process must be reformed. They want countries hosting future COP summits to be committed to phasing out fossil fuels and for conferences to be smaller and more frequent. The country currently hosting COP29, Azerbaijan, has been criticised after its president said oil and gas were a gift from God. BBC News has found it's still possible to buy zombie knives and machetes weeks after they were banned in England and Wales. The weapons were being advertised by UK knife retailers online. 4 knives were purchased and delivered, some of them from abroad.
Thank you. It is 27 minutes to 9. One of the fun facts revealed after the presidential election here in the US is that the voting precinct that contains Cook County Prison in Chicago narrowly backed Trump this time. In 2020, it had overwhelmingly backed Biden. The prison is home, of course, to men, in particular young men and often young black men. The divide between men and women was not in the end as huge as was predicted, but it was really striking in younger age groups. And the Democrats are being told that they have a men problem that they need to solve urgently. More on that in just a moment. First, though, the views of two young American men who've been talking to me here in New York. 26-year-old Walter Mejia is founder of the New York Republican Latinos and voted for Donald Trump. And Alex Levine, who's 24-year-old, he's a musician. He voted for Kamala Harris. I started with Walter and the buzz about the role of social media and podcasts in helping Trump get the votes of men.
We saw a revolution of the Trump campaign from 2016 to 2020 as well. Different podcasts overall where it established that bridge with young people, young voters in America. It gave him a platform. It gave him a voice, because part of the thing is, like, the candidate has a platform. He has a policy. But the other issue is, how do you bridge? How do you communicate to that young voting block? And so I think that this time around, President Trump and his team were very strategic and intelligent to go on Joe Rogan, Patrick Bedave, all these different podcasts. Even though he's a little older as a candidate, but a more energetic, more charismatic to, you know, discussing his issues with voters around America on these different platforms.
Alex, do you accept, as a Kamala Harris supporter, that she should have done more specifically to reach out to young men in the places where they are?
I think it would have been a negligible difference, and I'm skeptical that Trump going on these podcasts actually had a massive impact on converting votes. I think that most of the people, young men specifically, who rejected Kamala and the Democratic Party, I think that was already something that was brewing over the course of a long time. And I think that if Trump's appearances on Rogan or Patrick Bet-David did anything for him, I think that, you know, they more just symbolized how much that group of people, I guess you could say young men, those sorts of people, had already shifted over to that kind of point of view. there's been a kind of like growing alternative media environment in America. Lots of people on Substack, lots of people starting independent podcasts, people who had been at media institutions before, right? But had experienced some kind of, in their eyes, kind of like mini cancellation event or something like that, right? Which had pushed them away from the side that they used to be on, which was the progressive left. They took their audiences with them. And because of their experiences coming up against what they viewed as, you know, the progressive left trying to cancel them or something like that, the news that they proceeded to focus on for the next 4 to 6 to 8 years was, you know, what they saw as the excesses of the left, because they felt that they had experienced those excesses. So you had tons of people on Substack and podcasts that were just shining the light on these sorts of things. So I think that over time, it started to depict the left in America, the Democratic Party, as decadent and excessive and kind of crazy in a way.
Walter, is it also in part, should we be blunt about it, as some Democratic Party supporters have been, is in part it's sexism and possibly even misogyny among young men?
You know, being misogynist and sexist and all that, no, I don't think that young men started doing all these different things, started taking those angles because of that specific issue. It was very historic for President Trump to go on Joe Rogan. Why? Because Joe Rogan said many times that he was not going to have President Trump on the podcast. And then two, that he was never going to endorse President Trump. And what we ended up seeing, despite it being days before the election, we saw two things happen. We saw a straight endorsement by Joe Rogan on Twitter, actually. And we saw him breaking his own rule that he was never going to have President Trump on the podcast, which he eventually did. And by the way, Kamala Harris never even showed up.
Do you believe, Alex, next time round, and I'm thinking of the next presidential election, but of course there are congressional elections in 2 years' time, do the Democrats have to do anything to reach out to men? Is it a problem for the party, or do you just wait and they come back, do you think?
I think it's a very evident problem, and whether they'll do something about it remains to be seen, because you would have thought after the 2016 election, right, the first time Trump won, that there would have been probably more serious soul searching in trying to understand how that had happened, which I don't think there was. And I don't think tactics really changed for them in the next two elections. So now I would absolutely imagine that they'll be doing all the things that they didn't do this time around, including trying to go on Joe Rogan and trying to, you know, get into that alternative media ecosystem. I'd put money on it.
There we are, the views of two men in their 20s, Alex and Walter. Richard Reeves is president of the American Institute for Boys and Men. He's author of the book Of Boys and Men. When I talked to him, we began with the view that the Democrats lost the election really because of sexism and misogyny.
That view is not only wrong, but dangerously wrong. It's wrong. It's not supported by the evidence. There's no strong evidence of young men in particular turning away from gender equality. And the focus groups that I've seen suggest that when young men are confronted with that idea, that it's only sexism that could be driving their decisions, it propels them to the right. They're so offended by it. It would then, I think, be too easy an answer. Basically, what they'd say is that we weren't wrong. It's just that voters, and especially men, were wrong. They're in the wrong place. They should be where we are. Rather than really coming to terms with, the deeper problem, which is that the Democrats and the left more broadly have actually failed to acknowledge and address many of the issues being faced by men, especially young men. And that has just, I think, left them open to a competing political pitch.
Tell us about those issues and the way in which, in your view, they have been ignored.
To take a particularly tragic example, the suicide rate among young men in the US has actually risen by 40% just since 2010. That's men under 30, and is four times higher than for women. And so in the US now, we're losing about 40,000 men a year to deaths from suicide, which is about the same as the number of women that we lose from breast cancer. And so it's a public health crisis of that magnitude. But the Biden administration, CDC, don't acknowledge the gender gap in suicide. There's no White House task force on male suicide. There's no Office of Men's Health to go along the Office of Women's Health. And actually, I've been struck quite often how many people don't even know that there's such a huge gender gap in risks from suicide. The problem with the debate about gender is that it's asymmetric. It's not that we shouldn't be talking about the problems of women and girls. Of course we should. It's just that we should also be talking about the problems of boys and men. But that's almost been something that's been unsayable on the political left.
Yeah, but that's the interesting point, isn't it? Unsayable why? What is it that drives the unsayability of it?
It feels like the fear is that by embracing or acknowledging some of these real challenges that boys and young men have, I mean, after all, in higher education now in the US, there's a bigger gender gap on college campuses today in the US than there was in the 1970s, but the other way around. So kind of women are further ahead of men today than men were ahead of women in the 70s. So these are real problems. But what people will say on the left is, we don't want to give the impression that we care less about women's issues and girls' issues. And if we talk about the issues of boys and men, it will sound like that. They have convinced themselves that even addressing the issues of boys and men will somehow dilute their claim to be also fighting on behalf of women and girls. And that's just flat wrong. It's like saying you're a parent and you're only allowed to care about your son or your daughter. You know, which one will it be? And of course, in the real world, you know, there are women out there worried about their own access to healthcare, perhaps, but also worried about their sons at school and their husband's mental health. That's the real world. And for some reason, the Democrats ended up in a position where they simply silenced themselves on male issues and wouldn't even go to the places where young men especially got their news from or where they kind of engaged in the debate, most famously, of course, the Joe Rogan show.
How hopeful are you that next time round they learn these lessons?
It depends on what the story is that the Democrats tell themselves about why this happened. Story number one is this was sexism. And until and unless we can convert the American population and the men especially away from this outdated misogyny, then we'll never win. We have to change the voters to a more progressive mindset. Story number two is we have actually created this problem by neglecting these issues of men and boys, and sometimes by pathologizing them, by saying that they're the result of toxic masculinity or similar. And so we need to do some really hard thinking about how to set out a progressive agenda and a progressive story about how we are going to help boys and men.
Richard Rees, thank you very much for talking to us.
It's coming up to 16 minutes to nine.
And we turn to the British economy, because economic growth in the UK slowed between July and September to a measly 0.1%. That is what we have been told this morning. And the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has this morning been making it clear that she's not happy.
Growth is the number one mission of this government, to turn around the poor performance of the last decade or so. Am I satisfied with the numbers published today? Of course not. I want growth to be stronger, to come sooner, and also to be felt by families right across the country.
Our economics editor, Faisal Islam, has been hearing from the Chancellor in the last few minutes and joins us now. Faisal, I mean, there is a charge that can be levelled at her, isn't there, that some of the things she said and other ministers said during the course of the summer had the effect of dampening growth. Was she asked that? Does she in any way, shape or form accept it?
So the chart that we will be showing, which you obviously can't show on the Today programme, raises some questions.
No, we're not good with charts.
Growth was 0.7, 0.5 in the first two quarters, and it has gone down to 0.1, barely growing, in a three-month period, which was almost entirely under the Labour government, and which was definitely marked by a different story about the economy. And it was also at the same time when interest rates started to be cut. You know, you could have expected that to have a certain amount of energy in the economy. That did not happen. And I think that there are some questions being raised by business groups, quite understandably, about the tone of the story around the economy when Labour first came into office over the summer. I think they toned that down later on, towards the end in September. This doesn't include really the period of the budget and the aftermath, so the anticipation of it, I think, may have had an impact on dampening down animal spirits in the economy, animal spirits that really should have been lifted by the interest rate cuts.
So what's happening now? I mean, did you get the impression that Rachel Reeves actually does believe that we have turned a corner or not?
The sense I get is that they have very much done a phased approach, that the budget was about what they say sort of stabilizing everything, And now they really do want to talk about growth. We saw that last night with the Mansion House reforms on pensions. This very interesting form of words about all of the post-crisis regulation that they had, quote, gone too far, and that she wanted to send the message to the financial community that they could go out there and take risks that would foster growth. We're going to see a series of these announcements that will push in, I think, to politically difficult territory where there's a choice for growth versus some political pain. They say that they will go for growth. That doesn't necessarily stretch, you know, into Brexit, as we were have been talking about in the programme, and as indeed the Bank of England governor was encouraging. So I think their story on growth, what a lot of business people are saying, is they need the story on growth, which was not exactly at the centre of the budget. They need to hear that much more fully. And certainly after these figures, they're going to want that. And it's worth remembering that on per capita terms, so when we account for population, in that third quarter, it actually fell by 0.1%, which is, again, the first time this year that that's happened.
First, Lisa, thank you.
It's 13 minutes to nine. Iran says it plans to open a treatment clinic for women who defy the mandatory hijab laws that require women to cover their head in public. The authorities say this will offer scientific and psychological treatment for hijab removal. Farhanak Amidi is the BBC World Service Women's Affairs reporter. Good morning.
Good morning, Katya.
So news of this treatment comes after a young woman was arrested outside her university last week and forcibly transferred to a psychiatric hospital. That's after she stripped to her underwear in protest after reportedly being harassed by security officers over her hijab. So how common is it for protesters or dissidents in Iran to be taken to clinics?
Well, the Islamic Republican authorities have used psychological torture and psychiatric treatments as a means of torture for political dissidents and women before as well. And also labeling women hysterical or mentally unfit if they take off their hijab. So it was a few years ago in 2017 when a few women started to, that was like the when everything about hijab, the protests about hijab started gaining speed and pace. It was in 2017 when some women started taking off their hijab in public for the first time and putting it on a stick and just standing in a corner on a busy street. And many of those women were called mentally ill, and their families were put under a lot of pressure to come out and say that these women did this because they were not mentally feeling well. So now this whole announcement is really starting to worry some people. Of course, a lot of people are making jokes and creating memes on social media, but there is genuine worry that women might be taken to psychiatric hospitals and be psychologically tortured because of this experience that we know that the regime uses these techniques to torture political prisoners.
And what do we know specifically about this new planned treatment clinic?
So this clinic announcement was announced by something like a ministry, which is actually quite very unique to the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, and it's called the Headquarters for Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. So they say that these clinics will be treating teenagers, youth, and women who have been forced, quote unquote, to take off hijab because of environmental and social pressures. Now, this does sound ironic because Iran has mandatory hijab law. So you are, as a woman, forced to wear hijab from the age of 6 when you attend school. But they say that there is social pressure. Excuse me. And there is social pressure on women, especially younger women, to take off their hijab. Now, what do they exactly mean by this? We don't know. But it seems that because more and more women are taking off their hijab as a protest against this mandatory hijab law, they want to control it in this way. They say that because Recently, a law was passed called the Chastity and Hijab Law by the Majlis, or the Iranian parliament, which penalizes women for taking off their hijab or for wearing their hijab loosely or not properly. Now, the punishment can be fines or notices, but it can go up to confiscation of your vehicle, imprisonment, and even physical punishment like lashes. Now, they say that as part of this law, judges have been encouraged to send women to these clinics as part of their punishment.
Farhanak Amidi, thank you very much indeed.
It is 9 minutes to nine. Just to tell you, there's another chance to hear the musical choices of the former footballer Ian Wright on this morning's Desert Island Disc. That will be at nine. And on BBC Sounds, all the news programmes, Nick and Amal talking on the Today podcast about the farmers' revolt. And on Newscast, the COP climate talks.
It is 9 minutes to nine. Now, can a subject like English literature survive as a degree course amidst the financial travails of universities in England? The Office for Students has revealed the cash flow woes of universities in England are worse than thought initially. Their predictions, a third have serious cash flow problems. In an interview with the BBC, the regulator's chairman, Sir David Behan, said course closures and university mergers might be needed for financial stability. So which courses are most likely to get the chop, and what impact would that have on us as a society? Well, joining me to talk about that, James Marriott, columnist at The Times, who's written about university finances. He's with me in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us, Nick Hillman, director of the Higher Education Policy Institute. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, James, courses like English have become less popular, and languages too. What would be the impact if fewer universities offer humanities?
I think it's difficult to assess, because we've got used to talking about the value of university degrees in, I think, very materialistic terms. We're thinking about how much graduates are going to earn afterwards. We're thinking about the money that graduates will make. And also, I think humanities are increasingly encouraged to justify themselves in terms of employability and these transferable skills. And I think it's sort of, we need to get back to making the case for the humanities being important in themselves, that people studying English literature and history and foreign languages at university is important, you know, not just because we want graduates to have good jobs, but because those things are intrinsically worthwhile. We want people in our society who understand history, who understand the past. We want people who, you know, understand music and understand English poetry. And I think part of the problem, as we're looking at these closures of humanities departments, which are becoming more frequent in recent years, is that people have got too used to trying to justify the humanities in terms of employability and skills. And if there's a future for the humanities, we've really got to start making the case that they matter in their own right for themselves.
Mm, I'll come back to that in just a moment. Nick Hillman, if universities need to make savings, do you think it's English literature and humanities that are, they're going to be the ones that disappear?
Well, there are problems on the demand side for those sorts of subjects. For example, English entrance to A-levels are down significantly, so there's fewer people applying. But when it comes to the supply of courses from the perspective of a university, those are actually the cheaper courses to put on. It's things like engineering and physics and chemistry that actually cost more because the facilities are so expensive. So there is a funding crisis across the board in universities at the moment, and I don't really like playing one type of discipline off against another. I think they're all important, but the issues are different.
And Nick, do you think that if there's a funding problem, which there clearly is, that the government will hike fees higher? And could that actually then lead to fewer students applying? Because we already saw the universities expected more undergraduates than they actually got.
Yes, well, it's a good thing the new government has just raised fees in line with inflation. But every single penny of that is being snaffled back by the increase in national insurance contributions. So it's not actually enough. And we know that raising fees, you know, we're mainly talking about raising fees in line with inflation as the value of money changes. That doesn't put off demand. It didn't even put off demand when fees were tripled to 9,000 pounds. And we've got to remember what that money is used for. Nobody likes paying high fees particularly, but our money is going on their education. And if fees goes up, it's easier to keep these courses open.
James, will the fees go up?
I don't know. I mean, you can see the strong argument for it because universities are not going to get any richer and the problem is only going to grow. I think it probably is inevitable.
And Nick, I mean, I remember that we used to be seen as a special case in the UK. The rest of Europe, students were funneled to vocational degrees. Does it concern you? People may not study Shakespeare or the classics. Is it in this realm we have to stay ahead of AI?
Well, look, there is a curriculum review going on under someone called Becky Francis for the secondary school curriculum. And people in universities are not talking enough about that because that is the pipeline. What goes on in school determines what happens at university. For example, we have a very we're unusual in people only doing three subjects in sick form, which determines what they can do at university. So I think universities need to look much more closely at what is going on in schools and that curriculum review. We're unusual in the UK in another way, in that we are quite a small country relative to China or India or America, but we're strong in all sorts of disciplines. We're not just a STEM country or just a humanities country. We're strong across the board. And as James said, as the world changes, that is a massive strength. And I do hope policymakers remember that when they make these funding decisions.
Thank you very much indeed. James Marriott, columnist at The Times, who's written about university finances and just speaking to me just last, Nick Hillman, director of the Higher Education Policy Institute. Thank you. And Justin, still with us in New York, the last program that you are hosting from the United States, what a 10 days it's been.
Well, for a week or two,
and
I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and you look ahead now to the beginning of next year, not just to the inauguration and his speech, but also to day one and the things that he does and the things that he can get through. And, you know, we were hearing earlier in the program, there is a real possibility that some of his picks won't get through, some of his cabinet picks, you have to go in front of the Senate, but that some will. And this is going to be a very different world. And it's certainly, you know, traveling around the US, I have to say there's much less shock than there was in 2016. I suppose that's obvious because they've seen it before. But I think it's fair to say there's a sense among Democrats that they have an awfully big task to undertake now, but also a kind of more relaxed sense about the nation than I think some people were expecting. And also kind of understanding that maybe something cultural has changed. It's storing quite a few of the papers here about the Congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, so very much on the progressive left of her party, removing her pronouns from her X account. Now, I don't know whether she did it recently, but it's been noticed recently. There's this kind of sense of every kind of waiting now for a big cultural change that might come, quite apart from all the kind of more kind of gritty political things that we've been talking about during the course of the programme.
We focus very much on, you know, who Trump has chosen for his top table, whether or not he gets all his picks, as you say, we have to see. But do you mean the public in the United States is also more relaxed than expected, not as divided?
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, people were desperate for it not to be close so we didn't end up going to Pennsylvania and hanging around and people kind of shouting at each other and potentially worse. And that didn't happen. And to be honest, I think in a sense, the biggest feeling that there's been since